Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show, Avengers Endgame. It is the movie of the moment of the year? I don't know, but it's a really big movie. Y'all have seen it, I'm pretty sure. In case you haven't, we're not going to spoil it until we get to our review, so you can listen until that point. We're also going to talk a little bit about the news on Persona 5R and Persona 5S, and what it's like to play Legend of Zelda in cardboard VR. All of that and more on the show this week, but the main event is Avengers. Sean, this fucking movie, right?
Fucking, yeah. Holy shit, dude. It's crazy. It's crazy.
When we started this podcast, it was 2012, was year one of this version of the podcast. So Avengers had not come out yet, The first one. But we were on the cusp of it. Avengers was one of our like first podcasts, I think, right?
Yes.
And could you imagine some of the images from the last hour of this movie ever being in a movie when we started in this podcast?
I mean, God, no. I mean, I've been thinking a lot recently about the, you know, because it's easy for me to remember our perspective before Avengers because we podcasted about it. And like you said, that was for like this version of the podcast or whatever. That it's like the very beginning of this podcast was a lot of the stuff around the Avengers coming out. And we had so many discussions about how much of a big gamble that was at the time because it was something nobody had ever done before. And so it seemed like this is the make or break moment for the Marvel Cinematic Universe was that first Avengers movie. And then that movie was amazing. And it's weird to think back to that moment when this seemed like a gamble.
Yeah.
And then to be here in 2019, 11 years later, from the beginning, from the Iron Man movie, and just see Avengers Endgame and be like, holy shit, like that, how far they've come and how much they can get away with now. With these movies is completely and utterly unprecedented. It is probably something I suspect that will never be replicated because The circumstances to create this movie are so absurd, and there's a lot of talent, but also a lot of luck that went into getting to this point to be able to do this just absurd bullshit that they do.
I mean, just yeah, you're so right. I think this is a great movie. Would you agree? It's
fantastic. Yeah, it's a very similar level of quality to me as Avengers Infinity War, which means it's up in the upper echelons of these films, for sure.
And I think it's even better than that. I think it's, yeah, the line I've kind of had in my head is I think Black Panther is the best movie Marvel has ever made. Mm-hmm. I think Endgame is the best Marvel movie. Do you know what I mean by that? Of like,
yeah,
Black Panther as a movie, like, take it out of the MCU, it's just a really, really good film. Endgame is very good, I think, but I also just, it is so the epitome of what Marvel was built to deliver, and I agree, there's never been anything like this. The experience of sitting in the theater, watching this movie unfold, feeling the culmination of 22 films in 11 years, there's never been anything like it, and I think it's a special moment.
Yeah, I agree that it's something where, you know, people can make a movie like Black Panther or Thor Ragnarok or any of those standalone Marvel movies. Like, they are enhanced by existing in the cinematic universe in many ways, and that part of them is fun. But yes, like, only the Marvel Studios studio could make Avengers Endgame. Like, this movie can only be produced under these circumstances, whereas Black Panther could exist more or less unchanged, theoretically, in, like, a different world where they didn't have the shared universe and they just made standalone movies. Black Panther would just be a great standalone superhero movie in that context. But no other context would allow Avengers Endgame to exist. And that's one of the things that's so incredible about it. And, like, you know, it's one of my best, like, theater-going experiences in recent memory is going to see this movie. Because it's just, like, a huge communal event, the likes of which our culture has mostly lost. I think the only other one that we have is Game of Thrones. And I don't watch Game of Thrones, so that's not one for me. So this is, like, one of the only big, huge, like, nation-spanning, and not even, like, world-spanning cultural events and sort of storytelling events that I feel like I am, like, participant to. And that's a very unique feeling in this world where we're so sort of segmented off in our own sort of fandom ghettos to have all that come together and have the sense of, hey, we all really think that Captain America and Thor and Iron Man and all these people are really dope, and so let's watch 3 hours of that just being ridiculous and awesome.
I totally agree, and I think it has been, you know, in the weeks leading up to Endgame, I just noticed, you know, I'm in school, I'm on a college campus, everyone was talking about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone had plans to see it, because if you didn't get your tickets in advance, you were fucked. And, you know, that was special. I saw the movie Thursday night. Friday morning, I go to a coffee shop. People in the coffee shop are talking about it, and I talk to them about it. I go to school, and I'm teaching some classes. All my students are interested in talking about it, but we don't spoil it because not everyone's seen it yet, you know?
Yeah.
And but we're all hyped about it. All weekend, talking about it online. My brother is in Japan. He's in Nagano. I said, Thomas, you have to see it. And he's like, all right, that's this week. And he left the building and went to see it, and he had not been to a movie theater in Japan yet. And he's like, they have it both subbed and dubbed into Japanese. And he's like, I really want to see this dubbed in Japanese, but I think I'll see it in English first to know the story. And I'm like, you need to see it in Japanese, but yes, see it in English first. And that was just, again, just the, you're correct. It's this and it's Game of Thrones, which my roommate is watching upstairs right now. So if you hear Game of Thrones, that's what's going on. He's watching last week's episode. And it is kind of weird to have these going on at the same time, because mm-hmm. it does feel like the last call for a certain kind of communal entertainment.
Yeah, that just, again, I just, it's hard for me to foresee something like this happening again, because Game of Thrones sort of got grandfathered into that position because it started right around when everything started to get totally segmented off. But it was still, Game of Thrones was still from that era of sort of like water cooler television. It was just at the very, very end of it. And I just can't really foresee other TV shows coming in and being able to do that on the way that Game of Thrones did it. And I certainly, you know, lots of other movie studios have sort of tried to do the Marvel thing. None of them have even gotten close. None of them have even really gotten off the ground. The closest to getting off the ground was the fucking WB movies for the DC superheroes. And I guess you say that they got off the ground and then they immediately crashed in a, you know, spectacular fire.
Here's a fun stat. In 3 days, Avengers Endgame has almost doubled the lifetime domestic gross of Justice League.
Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ.
Because I don't think Justice League even broke 200 million. Endgame is at 350 for the weekend,
mm-hmm.
which is, oh my God. All right. Sean, I said this on Twitter. I have not been this excited to do a podcast in a while. Not to say I don't enjoy the podcast every week, just I got out of that theater Thursday night, Sean, and I'm like, I need to fucking talk about this movie. And now we're here. So I'm very mm-hmm. excited, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. What else do we have going on before we move into that, Jonathan?
Do you want me to talk about Zelda?
I so desperately want you to talk about you strapping cardboard to your face and playing Zelda, yes.
Okay, so to recap, Nintendo earlier this month released the Labo VR kit, which is part of their Nintendo Labo series, which is where you take cool cardboard stuff and you construct it and make little toys out of it that you can play on the Nintendo Switch. The VR one is this cardboard headset, and you put it together and you stick your Switch in there, and then your Switch serves as the VR set and everything. And they announced right around the time this was coming out that they were going to release VR updates for Super Mario Odyssey and The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. Mario Odyssey would be a couple of new little levels that are VR specific, and Zelda would be the whole game. It's just a toggleable option. You can turn it on in VR. So that came, it was kind of funny. So Sean, I went to see Avengers Thursday night. I get home and I turn on Twitter and everyone's talking now about, like, everyone who's not in Avengers at the moment is talking about they just put out this update for Zelda. And I'm like, okay, I guess my evening continues. I just did Avengers, now I'm going to try Zelda. So I boot it up. I was going to try Zelda first because I was just more curious. And I'll admit, I have not tried the Mario one yet.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I've had like a super busy weekend with Avengers, and then I'm working on a project and all this stuff, so I haven't had a ton of time, and I've mostly just stuck to Zelda. I have done 4 sessions with it, and I will preface all of this by saying I am more positive on the experience now than I was on Thursday night. I don't think it's good, but I think it's kind of an interesting novelty. But Thursday night, oh my God. So Sean, I boot this fucking thing up, you know, I stick it onto my face. I think I can still turn it on. No, okay, it doesn't want me to do it right now. Okay, I was going to see if I could turn this thing on and make it do the VR so I could talk about it. But that's okay. I turn it on. If you have the motion controls on, which for Zelda, the motion controls do all of your like bow, arrow, aiming, and stuff like that.
Right.
If you have that on by default, the game starts with head tracking on, which means that as you move your head, it moves the viewpoint of the camera. Now, it is still third person. It doesn't create like a first person, you know, Skyrim-esque view to be more VR-esque. You are still third person behind Link, but basically your head doubles as the right joystick, and you can move, you know, 360 and look around in the game. So I sit down in my chair, the chair I'm sitting in right now, so I can swivel around. I hold it up to my face because there's no headset, and I turn it on, and I go into the game, and I turn it off about 5 minutes later, and I start tweeting about it. And the more I write, the more I realize how sick I feel, because my immediate reaction was, oh, God, my eyes hurt. My eyes hurt really bad. Maybe it's just because I'm tired, you know. Avengers is a long movie. I got home at like 11 o'clock. Maybe that's it. But no, Sean, now I'm feeling a headache. My eyes hurt. Okay. Also, I'm really sweating. Why am I sweating? It's not that hot in here. Oh, right. Zelda runs on the Switch. This is not like PSVR or something else where the VR set is just the screen, but it's hooked up to the computer or the PlayStation elsewhere. The Switch is the computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Zelda, a graphically intensive game, is running on Switch. Switch has this fan. There is a hole in the VR headset for the fan, but even then, the system will get hot. So you stick this little Switch running hot because it's running Zelda into your cardboard. The whole cardboard thing is going to get really hot. In about 5 minutes, I'm holding it there. I'm sweating. My eyes hurt. I have a headache. And then I start to feel nauseous. I didn't feel nauseous while playing, but then it comes on me. And I want to stress, I have never felt motion sickness. Like, Sean, you've talked about it before, and it's a foreign concept to me. Not that I don't, like, believe it exists or anything. I just have not experienced it. I now know what it feels like. Because you put Zelda up to your eyes, it is... What they have to do, of course, is on the single Switch screen, split the game into two images. Zelda runs at the highest resolution, 720p, on the Switch screen. But you have to cut that in half, because you're doing two images of it. So it's very low res. The frame rate, which in Breath of the Wild has been improved over patches, but can still be a little inconsistent here and there, takes a serious hit in if anything is going on. You hold it up to your eyes, you can just count the pixels, basically. You can just see the lines of pixels. You can count them if you want. Another thing about LaboVR that is a little concerning is that, obviously, your Switch, like, gets dust on it and stuff through normal use, and you hold it up to your screen, and you can just see all the dust, which makes it hard to play. The colors get pretty washed out. It's very low res, and the worst thing for Zelda is that everything gets so fuzzy, especially in the distance, and Breath of the Wild is infamously a game with great draw distances that really wants you to look at the horizon. That becomes harder to see. The 3D effect is very mild. If you're using the head tracking, it just feels so fucking weird to be moving your head around, but Link stays stationary and all of that. And then if you turn the head tracking off, it's a little better, but it is still weird to, as you've said, Sean, have your head just static, but then you're moving the camera and it's going all over the place. Yeah, that first experience with it was not good. I thought I'd been playing for more than 5 minutes, but I looked at the clock and it had only been 5 minutes, and I was like, I had to go, like, lay down with my eyes closed, Sean. It was bad.
Yeah, no, Jonathan, can I just read your series of tweets you made?
Oh, sure.
Because my experience of this was just me sitting at home, because I didn't go see Avengers Thursday night, because me seeing, like, a late screening of Avengers is equivalent to me getting, like, 3 hours of sleep, because I have to get up at 5 in the morning, so I wasn't going to fucking do that shit. So I was just sitting at home, and I started seeing you tweeting. And so, yeah, it starts with you, you see that article from Kotaku, and you say, oh, I just got home from Avengers to see these have launched. This is my next adventure, I guess. Next tweet, all right, about to lock my Switch into this fucking cardboard death trap and give Zelda a VR spin. Pray for me. Because I was basically just watching these tweets come in real time because I was so excited to find out you were finally doing it. Next tweet. You know, it's not horrible, it's not great, it's not the optimal way to play the game, and after 5 minutes, my eyes hurt, I have a mild headache, my entire face is hot because the Switch gets really warm wrapped in cardboard playing a graphic-intensive game, but okay, it's bad. It is sort of novel to see Hyrule in VR, and I had fun riding around on my motorbike, but yeah, my eyes are seriously sore, and the headache is real. Ouch. Also, realizing I'm mildly dizzy, I don't know if I have the stomach to try Mario tonight. I've never had even a hint of motion sickness my entire life, and I feel very, very bad right now. So be careful if you're going to try Zelda in Labo VR. Yeah, no, not trying Mario tonight. Sorry, guys, it hurts to even look at a screen right now. I'll take a tankard of Dramamine this weekend and try it again so I can talk about it on the podcast. I'm doing this so you don't have to. And then you tweeted at me, better be fucking happy. And I said, this sounds like everything I dreamed of and more.
Yeah. That first tweet where I say, it's not horrible, it's not the optimal way to play the game. That tweet, you can probably tell, turned out, I really was going to do the, it's not horrible, it's not optimal, but here's what's cool about it. And as I typed, I was like, ugh, I'm kind of woozy here. And I just, you could just feel in real time, like me processing, I have taken the screen away from my face and I am feeling increasingly sick.
Yeah. And so, you know, this probably says bad things about me, but I found that so hilarious to just see that coming in, be like, oh, Jonathan's like going to vomit tonight or something from playing, like, because that was my dare to you that I made, was I just wanted you to play as for as long as possible until you physically cannot.
Yeah. No, I mean, when I said I was riding on the motorbike, here's what made me pull it away from my face, Sean, is I'm on my cool Zelda motorbike. I'm going through Hyrule Field. And what I did is I got in my chair and I just spun around. So I held the A button. So he's accelerating Link. And I spun myself as the camera around Link as he's speeding through a field. And I got back around to the front of Link and I just went like, oh my God. And like, I think I hit my desk and then that like threw everything off. And then I had to take it away. I'm like, nope, this doesn't, I don't feel so good, Mr. Stark. This is bad.
Man, that's amazing. So then what were your other experiences like after that initial hazing?
Take two. I decided, okay, I'm going to try it again. Because the other thing is also just having to hold it up to your face.
Mm-hmm.
Your arms get so tired so fast. So I thought, okay, I'm going to turn off the motion controls so there's no head tracking. So it's just looking into a 3D screen. And I turned that off, and then I laid back on my bed here, and I rested this on my face, like, you know, okay, like that. Sean just saw it through the camera. It looks dumb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I did that. And I should note, though, this time, so the first time I had my glasses on, the second time, so I wear glasses because I am nearsighted, which means I can't see things far away.
Yeah.
I think this, yeah. So, yeah, I took my glasses off and I put this on because it is kind of uncomfortable to do this with glasses, like anything, like 3D glasses, any VR, obviously, glasses are always a problem for this. Which I feel like we just all need to have a conversation about because this is the most common disability in America.
Yeah.
A lot of people wear glasses. But anyway, so I took the glass off, put this on, was resting it, you know, on my head, and I had the Joy-Con in my two hands, and I played it. I got about 10 minutes in this time. I did feel a little queasy moving the camera around with my head locked into place. This time, but other than that, I didn't feel bad this time. My eyes did hurt a little, and it does get uncomfortably hot. But, like, I was able to play it. I ran around for a little bit. I went to, you know, some places I wanted to see. And I'm like, okay, there's some cool things about it. It is cool to, like, be in the world and everything looks kind of big. But overall, I couldn't get past the low resolution. It's just such an ugly version of the game. It didn't feel right to me. And everything was so blurry. And I couldn't even read the text. And so I turned it off and I'm like, I'm probably never going to play this again. And then the next, so that was Friday, and I think it was Saturday, so yesterday from when we're recording this, I decided to give it one more try because, I don't know, just something was calling to me. This time I probably spent a good 20 minutes in it. Same thing with on the bed. I did put my glasses on this time. And this is one thing. Sean, you or someone needs to explain to me the science of this, that if I'm looking at my phone at this distance without my glasses, it's fine. But if I put a VR headset on without my glasses at that distance, it's blurry, like I'm looking at something far away. What's the science of that?
I think it is that literally when you're engaging with anything that is simulated 3D, your eyes are literally focusing on something in the distance. So you're like the lenses in your eyes are focusing on things in the distance if you're looking in the distance in simulated 3D. And so any sort of issue you have that would prevent that in real life, like just looking outside, it would still have that issue because, like, again, your eyes are, like, physically contracting or expanding depending on what you're trying to focus on. And so that, from my understanding, that is why that is a thing that exists even when you're doing simulated 3D, that you still need to wear glasses regardless of how close the screen is to your face.
That makes sense. It just, it was, like, confusing to me because I don't know the science of this. And so, yes, I did find out I really do need to use my glasses with it. It got a little bit clearer for me. And this time I just kind of tried to take it slow. I was a little more used to how it looks. And this is by no means the optimal way to play the game. I cannot imagine playing this for more than 15, 20 minutes at a time. But it is kind of fun, if you know the game world, to just put it on, run around, go to Kakariko Village, or I really like going near Rito Village and all of the highlands in the desert there, and kind of looking at things, you know, climbing a mountain in VR where the mountain looks like to scale is kind of cool. And there's some, like, I was just trying it one more time before we started today, Sean, just to kind of remind myself, and I was in the snowy area in the mountains, which is like the northwest of the map. And that looked kind of cool with, like, the snow falling, and, like, I got up to this mountain where there's a big flag waving, and the flag kind of is waving in my face. And that's kind of neat. Like, it is, I think, considering the severe technical limitations of doing this on the Nintendo Switch, that this is, one, this is not what LaboVR was really built for, right? Mm-hmm. Like, LaboVR is really built to do all of the Labo stuff, what they call the toy cons, the little toys you make and those gimmicks, and those work totally fine. Zelda is a graphically intensive game that was not built in any way for VR. This is a patch onto it. And yet, I think there's some cool pleasures to be had from it. You can't help wishing, you know, this was running on a screen that was higher resolution and had a little more horsepower so it could fully render all of the graphical details and not drop the frame rate here and there. But, you know, for what it is, it's kind of cool. I think you've got to consider that this is purely a bonus. They're not charging you extra for the mode. The headset itself is, you know, $30-$40 at the most basic level, so it's very cheap. Again, this is not the primary thing it's used for. I'm not in any way angry that Zelda turned out this way. This is pretty much what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. There are some cool things about it. I don't think I'm going to, like, make this a daily habit or something of running back into Zelda in VR. And, you know, I'm interested in trying out the Mario one, but I don't know. The whole thing just has me a little hesitant because, again, there's just some of those issues where, again, it's no one's fault. Like, I don't think Nintendo built any of this poorly, but, like, you can't erase the fact that the Switch has to be right against your face, and you can't erase the fact that the Switch gets hot when running Zelda. Yeah. And so the thing gets hot, and you start smelling cardboard, because when cardboard gets warm, it gets kind of cardboard smelly. So, like, all of that just, it's a very weird thing that they did here. I guess I'm kind of glad they did it, because why not? Like, you sure, know, if you can do it, add it in a patch. But, like, yeah, it's bizarre. I guess that's really, I don't know what more to say than that.
Yeah, like, and it makes me wonder, like, so if you're someone who's not prone to motion sickness and you had that kind of response to that initial session, for me, who's like, I don't get motion sickness frequently, and certainly it's not, like, when I was a kid, I would get it more often, but there have been a handful of games in the past. There have been a couple of first-person shooters on PC where if they have really, really tight FOV, your field of view, and so if, like, your angle of your field of view is very, very small on a PC shooter where the screen's very close to your face, that can sometimes make you a little bit nauseous. There's been one game, the Xbox Live Arcade release of Marathon Durandal, which was an old Bungie PC shooter from the 90s. That game can consistently, it's been years since I played it, but when I was playing it, it would consistently make me nauseous after about 10 to 15 minutes because of the really restricted FOV and, like, the really smooth movement in that game. Something about it really messed me up, which is, like, very common if you, like, Google it. Like, a lot of people who have issues with motion sickness playing that game would get it. I can only imagine if I tried to do that and play that thing, the living fucking nightmare, because the thing about motion sickness is it usually doesn't actually make you vomit. It just makes you feel like you're going to vomit.
Oh yeah, that's what I felt like. Yeah,
yeah, and, like, it making you nauseous, and then the thing you describe of like your face feeling very hot, like that was probably a combination of both the Switch being very hot and close to your face, but also feeling motion sickness does that to you as well. It makes your face really flush. Yeah. And so like the combination of all those things, that sounds like a, like as you described in your tweet, a cardboard death trap to me.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a fun novelty, and it's, you know, as you said, why not do it? You're not charging anybody for this weird extra free mode, but it is like, I don't think I would ever probably really try it, other than in that very like, as you like lay on the back on your bed, turn off all the motion shit, and just stare at the 720p screen for about 5 minutes, and then get out.
Yeah, I would be very, this is, you know, I am not recommending this. I would be very cautious trying it, and like know yourself and your habits around motion sickness, and also probably don't go in with everything on and all the bells and whistles, because I think that's probably, you could build up to that. Like I tried it again with the motion tracker on just now before we started recording, and I could do it a little more because I'm a little more used to it, but like, just be careful with it is all I can say. Mm-hmm. It is a, and if you have kids, obviously be careful with them and VR stuff. But you probably know that if you have kids. So yeah, it's a weird thing, but you know, that's Nintendo for you. I'm not sure how much better this is than the Virtual Boy.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if they will do this in the future and put out for like future games weird little VR things, or if this is purely just a like, I wonder how much of this is they developed these things internally to test to see how VR would work, and they're like, eh, fuck it, might as well put it out. Because it's very telling to me that both of these are modes for games that are like a year plus old.
Yeah.
And there have been more recent Nintendo games that have come out that are, that do not have any kind of this VR support. I guess it's a little bit harder to imagine how like Smash Brothers would support this, but still, it is telling to me that these are old games that they've released these modes for, and nothing very recent.
Yeah, I agree. That makes sense. All right, you want to move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
All right, so we've got some news. Not a lot of news, really, just Persona news. We're gonna hit this because we've been teased about this for fucking months now, and then we're gonna get on to Avengers. We finally learned this week what is Persona 5 R, what is Persona 5 S. We know the answer to both of those, and I have to say, Sean, mostly I just feel frustrated, and I think it's because the months and months of incessant teasing meant this was inevitably going to be kind of frustrating. But let's talk about the content itself. So Persona 5 R, we already knew it's called Persona 5 The Royal. We got specific details. It is coming to Japan October 29th of this year, of 2019, and it'll come worldwide in 2020. It is a PS4 exclusive, no Switch version, adds a new party member, Kasumi Yoshizawa, new areas, new confidants, including a counselor at Shujin Academy, a new theme song, which is pretty dope. It's a very good song, and more. There's a full trailer out if you want to look at it. It is basically Persona 4 The Golden, but for Persona 5. It looks very good. It's only on PS4. We can talk about that later, too. Yeah, that's Persona 5R.
Yeah, and I remember saying, it must have been last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever we learned that it was called Persona 5 The Royal, and we were talking about, like, it's probably just the Persona 4 The Golden or whatever of Persona 5. I was like, that I always said, I don't know if I'd be ready to play this game again. And then I watched the trailer. I'm like, oh, fuck it. I'm going to play Persona 5 for the third time. Why not? And continue my streak of never actually playing one of these games in New Game Plus, but playing them all multiple times. Like, this is just my life. This is what I do. I just play new versions of Persona games endlessly, but will never actually, like, platinum trophy any one Persona game. That's, like, mainline Persona RPG.
Yes. I have done Golden on New Game Plus, but I didn't get the Platinum because it's super easy to miss. Anyway, I'm excited for it. I think it looks good. I wish it were coming to Switch. We'll talk about that. But, you know, clearly this is exactly like Golden. They have added a ton of new stuff. You will not be lacking for new content. I do think there's a conversation to be had about, like, this as a full, I assume full price release. We don't know the price yet, but assuming it's a full price release in 2019, 2020, this feels a little weird compared to like when you would do it for Fess or the Golden, when you had no option to do downloadable content, or in the case of the Golden, you're putting it out on an entirely new platform. Like, there are some visual improvements to Persona 5R, apparently. Like, it's going to add some more active 4K support. But Persona 5 already looked very good. It does not look like it's a visual overhaul or anything like the Golden was. So some of me kind of wishes, like, it'd be cool if there was like a $20 DLC pack that would just like patch this in for me or something. But this is how they do it, and you know, I'm game for it. We're getting new music and stuff. Why not?
I mean, there's no doubt that like them releasing it as a full new game is exploitative, but like it's not the most exploitative thing that Atlus or like lots of Japanese game companies do, or like any game company does. But like this specific form of we're going to release the updated version of this game. I mean, the same thing with like Dragon Quest 11S or whatever. Like none of that. I guess they're not even releasing that version again on PS4, but none of that content is coming over.
Yeah.
And so that sort of methodology of it's not like the way that Western game companies do the Game of the Year edition, where that is like we've already released all this DLC. Here's an edition of the game that puts all that together in one package. If you've never owned the game before, this is more. This just like we have these two very distinct, discrete releases. And none of the content or anything is shared between them. So yeah, like that part is frustrating, but I guess I've been like just so immunized to it by dealing with that world for so long at this point. It's like, yeah, fuck it, of course they're doing this. At least it looks like there's a lot of new content in the game, so
yeah,
I'm fine.
I mean, Sean, I spent $320 importing all those Persona 3 Blu-rays. Uh-huh. We're in for a penny, in for a pound on this stuff, right?
I mean, yeah, I bought the Japanese version of Persona 5, and then I bought the English version of Persona 5, and then played it with the fucking Japanese voices because I got too used to them. So, you know, I will buy the game now for a third time. Now the question I have to ask myself is, do I buy and download the Japanese version on Halloween this year, or do I wait for the English localized release of Persona 5 The Royal? That's the hell that I'm living in.
Well, because we probably do want to talk about it on the podcast together, it would be nice if you waited, because I don't think you're going to buy it twice again. But
no, yeah, oh yes, no, I'm definitely not going to buy Persona 5 four fucking times, and with two of them being Japanese versions and two of them being English versions. But, like, there is now this podcast tradition I've created of buying Persona 5 months ahead of when you can, and then, like, holding it over your head. So, you know.
That's okay, yeah. Anyway, I am excited for it. I think, you know, there's still, for us, also the question of just, like, Persona 5 is so good, and it is so perfectly crafted. Mm-hmm. I wonder where they're going to, like, knock down the walls to build the new stuff.
Well, it sounds like they said that they're basically making that, like, there's that big kind of last section of the game, like, a month or two that you kind of skip over for story stuff in Persona 5 to not spoil anything. But, like, the last couple of months of the school year, more or less, you don't have access to. And it sounds like they're doing something to the story to make it so that you're actually, that section is playable. And it sounds like that's where Kasumi comes in as a new character.
Yeah. So I'm very curious. Definitely looks exciting. Then we learn about Persona 5S,
mm-hmm.
which I think will go down in history as the biggest tease in the history of video game teases, right?
I have to say, I had such a good time watching this happen. Happening while I was at work. And it was like, it was again, my like classic lunchtime. Let's be 5 minutes, like sealed away from the rest of the world for like 4 or 5 hours. Now it's lunch. Let me find out what has happened. And then like catching up to this release, I was very thrilled to find out how this all went down.
So Persona 5S, which everyone assumed would be the Switch port for good reason, because Joker is in Smash Brothers. Nintendo rolled out the red carpet for Joker in Smash Brothers. We assumed he'd come to Switch. It's called Persona 5S, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, Quest 11S is the Switch version of Dragon Quest 11, so there's precedent for the S game meaning the Switch game already.
Yes. The most popular JRPG series in Japan did it, so clearly Atlus is aware of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
As precedent. It's called Persona 5S. They teased this months in advance. In fact, they timed the tease of Persona 5S around Joker coming to Smash, like the announcement of that. So, like, these were all tied together. But no, it is not Persona 5 on Switch. It is Persona 5 Scramble, The Phantom Strikers. It is a Musou game from Koei Tecmo, a la Dragon Quest Heroes, Hyrule Warriors, Fire Emblem Warriors. It's one of those. It will be on PS4. And Nintendo Switch, so there will be a Persona game on Nintendo Switch, not the one you wanted, but a Persona game. And here's the thing, Sean, if there had not been the months of teasing and all that, this looks good. I like Musou games, I like Fire Emblem Warriors a ton. I have not played Hyrule Warriors yet, but I want to play that one. This looks great, it's got good music, cool graphics, I'll probably play this. But what the fuck, Atlus? Because they knew. They fucking knew this whole time. You do not call it Persona 5S on mistake. You do not time all of this around your big character and franchise coming to fucking Smash Brothers. Like, and also just the eminent amount of business sense it would make given the clear demand for that game on Switch. What the hell, Atlas? You guys are assholes.
Yeah, it was so amazing to see this happen. Because it, like, I found, like, my own emotional reaction to it was very interesting to me, because my gut response was like, oh no. It's like, oh no, it's not the Switch version of Persona 5. And then I was really bummed about it. And then I thought about it for a second. It's like, wait, I don't even own a fucking Switch. Why do I give a shit? And then I was like, oh, and this game is coming on the PS4. I came out on top. I'm just getting a Persona 5 Musou game. And it's like this like really weird like whiplash effect I had, where it's like I had this weird amount of empathy for a moment, and I'm like, why am I feeling empathy for something that's so dumb? I'm just benefiting from this. Who gives a shit? And now I'm really happy to have a Persona 5 Musou game. So this is great news. Because as opposed to it being a release of a game that would have not affected me in any way, now it's a release of a game that I actually kind of want. So this is okay. Two thumbs up from Sean Chapman.
Sean, why do you think Atlas is not? Because there are still fans out there holding on for dear life to the sinking raft that it will come to Switch. Like, no, it'll be E3 is when they'll announce it. Sean, I am 99.99 repeating to infinity percent confident Persona 5 will never be on Switch. There will never be a mainline Persona game on Switch. They are never doing it because this was the moment. They didn't do it.
Yeah. Why? I mean, I think there is a chance that Persona 5 could come to the Switch in like 3 or 4 years. It's not happening. Like, if it's happening, it's not happening soon. If it's happening, it's starting development like around now, and they're starting to work on the port. Like it's very clear to me that they were not ever like really doing that. Like, obviously now, since they have not announced that anyway, and the idea that they would then come out at E3 and announce it, is very peculiar, because they would have just announced, like, if it was just Persona 5 on the Switch, they would have announced that with Persona 5R.
Yeah.
Now that we know that Persona 5S is not that. And so since they didn't just say, here's Persona 5R, it's coming to PS4 and Switch and maybe like PC also or something else. And that was like, this would be the version of the game to go multi-platform, which that has happened, not with Persona, but with other JRPGs in the past. They've done that kind of thing. Since that's not what they're doing, again, like, if they ever port Persona 5 to the Switch, that's something that's going to happen in the future, not like in this immediate development cycle that we're seeing the results of.
And it is just, it's weird, I think. Like, it would, the PS, or the Switch is on the verge of outselling the PS4 in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge everywhere. These kind of games especially are such a big deal when they come to Switch. Like, every Final Fantasy Square Enix has been putting out on Switch is selling like gangbusters. They're always reaching the top of the charts in the eShop. So, like, it would just make business sense. Like, I would put good money on Dragon Quest XI S will outsell the PS4 version from last year in the States. I don't know about in Japan, but maybe. In Japan, it would have competition. But, like, it would make so much sense to do it. Them not doing it is a little bit frustrating. And again, if it weren't for all the teases, I wouldn't be frustrated, because it would just be life going on. It's the teasing. It's really, now we have to ask the question, why is Joker in Smash Brothers? I mean, I love it. It's cool. But like,
I mean, but then, so I thought about that, and then I backed up and was like, well, why is Cloud in Smash Brothers? Why is Solid Snake in Smash Brothers? Because it's like, it is this moment where it's like, well, I think the reason why we were all so convinced that it was happening was partially because we knew that there was all these like domain names and shit that were getting, so like it was clear that more Persona 5 stuff was happening right when that Joker announcement happened. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why we were so convinced. But there is precedent in Smash Brothers for characters that are not only Nintendo characters, are characters that effectively don't really appear on Nintendo platforms almost ever.
Yeah, I mean, but this one is like, it's extra out there, and I think it being a DLC that had this much attention drawn to it and that much like love poured into it, just, I don't know, it just makes it all the more kind of like, huh, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, I think it's a natural reaction for people, even if there is that history of like, you know, Cloud or Snake Snake at least had been in some, but like, it's weird. All I can say now is, you fuckers, Goku has been in more Nintendo games than almost anyone on that fucking roster. He better be in the DL fucking C. There are already 3 Dragon Ball games on Switch. You know how many Persona games there are on Switch? Fucking 0. Soon there's going to be 1. It's going to be a Musou game. You can tell me if that counts or not. Get Goku on fucking Smash Brothers.
Yeah, and if Musou games count, then get Lu Bu from Romance of the Three Kingdoms on fucking Smash Brothers also. I want Goku and Lu Bu to fight Joker. This is my dream.
You know what else I want now? I want a Dragon Ball Musou game.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, that would make sense. I just want to play Yamcha and mow down a million fucking Cybermen. Yamcha's Revenge.
Yes. They couldn't call it Dragon Ball Heroes because they already have that. I don't think there's a Dragon Ball Warriors game yet, although there very well could be.
There's Dragon Ball Legendary Super Warriors.
That's true. Sean, I was making a little slide for my class on anime. We talked about this a couple weeks ago, and I was counting how many Dragon Ball games there are, so I could just put that on the slide. I got to 100 and stopped, and I just went 100 plus. If Goku were in Smash Brothers, I think Mario would probably be the only person in that roster who's been in more games, right?
Probably, yeah. Because Mario has been in a lot of like weird spin-offs and like edutainment games and stuff like that.
Maybe Luigi. But
But even Luigi's not in every game that Mario's in. So, yeah. I think that Mario... And honestly, Goku might be out Mario.
Yes.
In terms of number of releases he's been in. So, put Goku in Smash Brothers. I'm glad that we're at the same conclusion from the whole kerfuffle around Persona 5 R and Persona 5S. Clearly, Goku just needs to be in Smash Brothers, and everything is forgiven.
Yes. All right. You want to talk about Avengers?
Oh, boy. Let's talk about that movie, Jonathan.
If you have not seen Avengers Endgame, we're going to spoil it in a couple seconds here. So, go see the movie. It's wonderful. I understand maybe you didn't get tickets. They sold out very fast. But go see the movie. It's great. Come back. Listen. Let's talk about the movie. And I guess I'll just start there with the spoiler thing. You know, sometimes I roll my eyes at the spoiler culture stuff, Sean. In fact, I do it a lot because it's kind of dumb. This is a movie that genuinely surprised me. I don't feel that often, especially out of this kind of movie. I generally see it coming. Like, with Infinity War, I was surprised they went there, but I thought that was a possibility that Thanos would just win at the end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This one, did you see them beheading Thanos before the credits opened and then going 5 years in the future and then having to time travel and Captain America wielding Thor's fucking hammer? I mean, man, this movie has surprises in it.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, like, it was a possibility that I had thought of like, I mean, because I think a lot of people thought of, okay, the time travel seems like it's going to have to be a thing, especially with, like, the Ant-Man tease at the end of Ant-Man and the Wasp and all that. But yeah, like, the specific nature of how the plot unfolds and, like, yeah, this really interesting, like, almost like mirroring of Infinity War, that it's another, like, I would never have thought that it would be another movie where they have to get the Infinity Stones, but now it's the heroes doing it as opposed to Thanos. Like, that sort of thing really did, that element of it surprised me a lot. Of there's a thoughtfulness to how this movie sits next to Infinity War that makes it feel like it's not just Avengers Infinity War Part 2, it's like a companion to that movie in a way that's beyond like a normal sequel. And that element of it in terms of like its plot structure really shocked me.
Because Disney's marketing also played this so well. Mm-hmm. None of this movie is in the trailers.
Yeah.
Like, and the trailers are actually very deceptively edited to make you think what you're seeing is different. Because most of what's in the trailers are in the first 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They showed you nothing. Not a hint of the time travel stuff. I think there's one shot of Thanos from the trailers that is at the end, but you would never know it's 2014 Thanos. It's such... I just sitting in that theater, the first scene with Hawkeye and his family is great. Then you have Tony and Nebula on the ship. Great scene. Captain Marvel saves them. All right. That's good. Captain Marvel's on Earth. And then Tony and Cap have a big blow up. And I'm like, oh, I thought they were going to be friends again. And then they go to space and Tony's not with them. And I'm like, this is weird. And then they get to Thanos. And Thanos is like, I destroyed all the stones. Fuck you guys. And they're like, oh, this is sad. And then Thor cuts him off and says, I went for the head. And I'm like, that was really cool, but also, I have no idea where this movie is going now. And then it cuts to 5 years later. I thought there would be like a 5 month time jump. 5 years is a lot. It's a really cool way to start the movie because it really decenters you and makes it feel like... Like, this movie does such a good job of honing in on the stakes. I think the 5 year time jump and the sense of hopelessness in that first hour... One, the first hour of this movie is one of my favorite things Marvel has ever done. It is so introspective and slow in the best way of getting you into these characters' new lives. And it's not the movie I was expecting, but I think it's the movie I wanted and needed, you know?
Yeah, because I think one of the things that I was worried about was it was going to do the thing that we've seen from a lot of like novel adaptations, like the Harry Potter 7 Part 1, Part 2 is a good example of this, where it's like it's basically one movie that's just sort of cut in half at two, into two parts. And obviously, like, Avengers at the very least never had a source material that sort of mandated a little bit that you would have to do that just for length reasons. But everything about, oh, they shot both the movies at the same time, the fact that the trailers never really hinted that there was going to be that kind of big time jump and all that, there's a part of me that was worried that it was just going to feel like that, and it just would pick up immediately after Thanos snapped his fingers, and it's the heroes having to pick themselves up together, and it's just like, why was this not just one, like, I mean, obviously we know why it would not be one fucking 5 hour long movie, but in terms of the plot and structure, it just would feel that way. And I think it was really smart of them to say, no, let's make both these movies feel very, very distinct. Obviously, you need to have watched Infinity War before watching Endgame to have, like, most of the emotional impact of Endgame, because I think you'd be very kind of... I think it would be clear what is happening to you, but you'd be sort of emotionally uninvested without Infinity War. But as long as you have that emotional investment, so much about this movie just stands on its own, and its structure... and its plot is so its own thing that it's tremendously to the movie's advantage to look at it that way and have it be two separate episodes of one larger story as opposed to be just one large story cut in half.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely its own movie. It's part of a serialized narrative, but I would compare it almost to like the Lord of the Rings movies. Mm-hmm. It does a very good job of being its own thing. And... you know, it's a very satisfying in a theater experience, these 3 hours of, it feels like it encompasses everything we love about the Marvel movies in one big 3 hour package. And, you know, that includes a lot of twists and surprises. It includes some things we maybe saw coming, but even the things we maybe saw coming don't happen the way I thought they would. And, you know, I think it's beautifully done. I think it uses, like, let's get into more general thoughts, I guess, about why we like the movie. You know, everything we've said so far, but I think it does so right by every character. This is something I've thought a lot about because there are moments that challenge me on this too, but the more I think about it, I think there are so many big moments in this movie. I think they are all resolutely in character. I think the characters are very well understood throughout, even more so than in Infinity War, because I was rewatching Infinity War the other night, and there are some parts where, like, Gamora feels a little off to me, or some of the other Guardians, or all the stuff in Wakanda just feels a little off in Infinity War from what we saw in Black Panther. There's really none of that in this movie to me. It all feels like it knows the characters really well. It puts them front and center. I love how introspective this movie is. There's some really interesting thematic stuff going on. There's just time that is downtime with the characters. Sometimes it's very funny. Sometimes it's very touching. But it takes the time to build all of that. Like, you know, as a 3 hour movie, we can talk about the runtime. I think if you gave me the movie and said, cut this down to 2.5 hours, I think I could do it. I don't think that would be impossible for the plot, but I think you would lose the heart and soul of the movie because so much of it is in letting things just breathe. I love that about it. I love that there is this distinct adventure in the middle of the movie with the time travel and that it puts the characters in interesting pairings and challenges them in interesting ways. And then the ending is just, it is epic, but it is also so overwhelming in paying off your love for this series over the last 11 years that everyone has said this on Twitter, and it's not a cliche, everyone in the theater was emotional at the last hour of this movie. I mean, there was a woman behind me, Sean, full body sobbing, like, loudly over the movie. It was a little over the top, but no one misunderstood why she was crying like that, you know? Because the things they do to Tony Stark at the end of this movie, and the way they twist the knife in, I mean, oh my God, when Happy Hogan talks about hamburgers to that little girl, I don't know how you can have a dry eye.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, because I watched Infinity War, like I finished Infinity War literally like 30 minutes before I left to go to the theater for Endgame. So like for me, it was like basically a two-parter. Because that was the first time I'd seen Infinity War since I'd seen it in the theaters. So it was my second experience of the movie. Infinity War, still really fucking good. That movie rocks. But yeah, there's something about the Infinity War is very much Thanos' story. And there's lots of time to have fun things with the different other hero characters in that movie. But it is about Thanos' like journey as this like twisted version of the hero's journey where, you know, he ultimately succeeds, but he succeeds at something that is horrible and monstrous, and he's never able to understand, despite the pleas of so many people, that like what he's doing is absurd and will never work. And then Endgame is like I like the little bit of the capper to Thanos' story you get in Endgame, which is his plan didn't fucking work because it's a stupid fucking plan, and Thanos still cannot see it because he's a stubborn asshole. And he like will never be able to understand why he's so wrong. So I do like that you get to like, you know, you don't have a lot of Thanos stuff in this movie, but I like the little capper you get to his story. But this movie is about the Avengers, and specifically it's about the original Avengers from the Avengers, from the movie from 2012. And it is a capper to their story, and it's the journey of all of them and seeing how they've changed from the end of Infinity War and then bringing basically all of them to some moment of resolution, whether or not, you know, some characters are clearly sort of like put to pasture in different ways. Other characters are still left in the world to be actors in future movies. But like everyone reaches some sort of end point for what has been their character arc and their character dynamic for all of these films. Like most of them being things that were set up in their original movie. For like Thor, and for Thor especially, like his is like this big round character arc. Iron Man and Captain America, their stuff is more stuff that comes up from Avengers, but still
the last image of this movie is Captain America getting the dance he promised in the first Avenger.
Yes, but I mean more that like his character arc is being the man out of time is what's resolved here, and that's more a thing from Avengers. But still, all their stuff is stuff that's either from their first movie or more concepts brought up from the first Avengers movie. And that's where I think so much of the emotional investment comes in, is that it is the culmination of this incredibly unique construct, which is, as we've talked about before, this meeting of TV and film, which has been happening on the TV side by TV shows getting bigger budgets and becoming more cinematic and more epic and all that kind of Game of Thrones, the HBO, like all that kind of stuff happening. And then on the other side, TV shows have been coming to movies with the MCU. And you're getting these like big standalone films, but have these characters that live and breathe across a decade plus of movies that you go and watch, that whether it's their own movies or little cameo appearances in other movies, we have lived with these characters for so long that seeing them change and come to a point of resolution is profoundly emotional.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I was surprised at how much of an ending this movie is.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, Sean, but there was always for me, like, just, I had to, like, there was always in my head, like, I trust Kevin Feige, the producer, and, like, the MCU a lot, but I also know this is a big multinational franchise run by Disney. Like, how much are they gonna let them end this, you know? Like, because there are not a lot of precedents for how definitively this closes some stories. You know, mm-hmm. like Tony Stark fucking dies and there's no out. There's no, he will live again. He is dead. We watch him die. We don't see him buried, but you know, we see the body, right?
Yeah.
Dark Knight didn't do that. Dark Knight Rises copped the fuck out of that one, right?
Yeah.
At the end of that movie. And a lot of superhero movies have done it. The closest would be Logan, the Wolverine movie. Wolverine dies in it, but Logan is also like so disconnected from the continuity of X-Men that it's not really a culmination of anything. It is its own movie. This is, you've watched Iron Man for 10 years and now he's dead. You've watched Captain America for 10 years and now he's not dead, but he's an old man. He's not fighting anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so you have those two, but also just the general sense of like having the entire Avengers army on the battlefield and having Cap finally say, "Avengers, assemble," and all of that, that this feels like if they announce tomorrow the MCU is done, that was it, it would make total sense. It feels like the end.
Yeah.
And that's, I love that they stuck to their guns. Like, they definitely, there's room to do more stories, and I'm excited for those. But it is profoundly satisfying for them to just say, no, you know what, we're wrapping this up. And that is really impressive to me.
Yeah, and that it feels like they're wrapping it up in a very thoughtful way. And it's nice that it's, you know, we don't end up in a scenario where, you know, they just kept on doing these movies, and then eventually, like, Robert Downey Jr. doesn't want to do them anymore, so you get, like, some shit like, you know, Star Trek Generations, Captain Kirk kind of thing, where it's just like, we don't really, like, we're trying to introduce new characters, now we have these old people in here, but we only have them for, like, a five-minute scene. Like, yeah, we'll just kill Tony, like, in this dumb way. Or, like, it feels like everybody is on board for this true ending, and you know, it's something that's both very exciting to see a designed conclusion to so many of these characters' stories, but then it also makes it more exciting to see what happens in the future, because I think it was sort of apparent that a lot of these characters, you'd like, particularly Iron Man and Captain America, I think sort of had run their course, and that was kind of clear by, I mean, one, they just hadn't made it a standalone Iron Man movie since Iron Man 3, which was a long time ago now. And then with Cap, like, I think it's hard to tell standalone Captain America stories in that movie format at a certain point, because he's such a sort of, like, unchanging, like, hard character, which is what's interesting about him, but, like, you can only do that so many times. And I think it was smart of them to say, like, let's put these two characters kind of out of the center, because that makes me excited to see, well, then how is it going to now grow in what is, like, now going to be, like, you know, we've talked about phase one, phase two, phase three, like, that's how they've structured all this stuff, but now it feels like a true actual, like, new phase of, like, we are moving on from this point. There will obviously be some characters that stick around, even some of the original characters, like Thor, will probably, like, I hope they make another Thor movie, because I like him so much and there's still so much you can do with him, but, like, I don't feel like I need a lot of Thor in a big other team-up movie or anything like that. Like, I'm excited to see what happens at this point forward. And that's one of the huge benefits of having an ending, is it allows new things to begin.
Absolutely. So where do you want to take this? I mean, this is a lot of movie. It's a big movie. It does a little bit of everything. We could just stay on the idea of endings and talk about that. We could save that for later. Where would you want to go with this discussion?
I think the easiest way to break down this movie is we need to talk about the characters, like, on their sort of individual tracks, because that has always been the thing about Marvel, is they just nail the characters down, and whether anything else in the movie doesn't work for some of their weaker movies, as long as those main characters have been really compelling and fun, those movies have been compelling and fun. And that's what all these movies understand about themselves, is that they are character first. It is about you falling in love with these heroes and wanting to follow them around on their journey. And this movie does such fascinating things with basically all of their main characters.
So do you want to just start with the main three of Iron Man, Cap, and Thor?
Yes.
Let's just do it. Tony Stark, they killed him.
Yep.
They did it so perfectly. Like, there's a lot I love about this movie. I think Robert Downey Jr. steals the fucking show. I think the Tony Stark stuff steals the show. Robert Downey Jr. deserves a fucking Oscar. He has deserved an Oscar for this for a while. Like, if Johnny Depp could get an Oscar nomination for Jack Sparrow, he should have a fucking, like, rack full of these, at least as nominations. And I think on the merits, he would deserve one for this movie, but also just as back pay for the last 11 years.
Yeah.
This is a character people will remember for as long as this kind of cinema is watched. I just think that's a fact. The emotions people had in the theater when he's dying, like... Again, I've never heard that in a movie theater, you know, like that kind of reactions. And he is so good. And I think the themes of fatherhood they introduce into this movie, you know, I did not really cry during the movie while watching Endgame. I got choked up at moments. There's three that did it when he's dying, and I'll talk about that. But the moment where I came closest during the movie is when he's talking to his dad, John Slattery, as Howard Stark, and they're just talking about fatherhood, and, you know, something that had been on my mind as this movie asks you to kind of be introspective about time, because it is the last of this 11-year cycle, and I was thinking about, where was I 11 years ago? And in 2008, when the first Iron Man came out, we were freshmen in high school. It was the end of that first year, because it had been May of 2008, and I would have seen it with my dad. I would have seen it at the mall theater near us, and you know, I remember that intimately. My dad and I went to all the Marvel movies together. We really liked doing that. And he died in 2012. I remember Thor: The Dark World was the first movie, Marvel movie, I saw after my dad died. And I remember we probably even talked about on the show how cathartic that was. Because it was, or maybe that was the year after that. I'd have to check the dates. But like, you know, so I had that on my mind going into this movie. And then those themes of fatherhood, just the scene with him and his dad hit me like a ton of bricks because it's such a beautiful adult piece of writing. And then after the movie, just in my car on the way home, I kind of broke down a little bit, I have to admit. And it's not just the movie, it's everything mixed up with that. But I am astounded by how utterly human Tony Stark feels by the end of this movie. And how even though, you know, the plot is Tony Stark snaps his fingers with a fucking glove made out of iron and these weird floating gem things, and that kills him so he can vaporize an evil alien army. It's ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. And yet the fallout of that is so intensely human that it hurts. Like, the line Gwyneth Paltrow has as Pepper to him when he's dying, where she says, "It's okay, we'll be okay, Tony, you can rest now." You know, we said that to my dad on his deathbed. Like, that's something you say to people who are dying. Like, don't worry about us, it's okay, you can let go. I never would have expected to hear that in a Marvel movie. When they are doing the little funeral at the lake and they put proof Tony Stark has a heart from Iron Man 1 in there. Just breaks your heart. And then when it is Happy Hogan just trying to tell this little girl, tell Tony's daughter, I will be there for you, and he does it through the hamburgers, and it makes you remember the scene in Iron Man 1 where Tony gets back from Iraq or Afghanistan, wherever he is, and he says, you know, we're going to have a press conference, but first thing I need an American cheeseburger. And just that little callback. There's a level of humanity to how they handle death in this movie that I think is astounding for any Hollywood movie of this kind of scale, but especially for a silly superhero movie where they're fighting a giant purple dude. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's a thoughtfulness to who this character has been, specifically in this like movie incarnation where a big defining thing for Tony has always been that he's an orphan. Like, and it's not something that they don't do it Batman style where he just goes on and on and on about it all the fucking time and has nightmares about his mother's pearl, like all that fucking shit you can never seem to get away from with Batman. But, you know, it's been a constant theme in all of his movies of stuff because, you know, he's the one who inherited, you know, Stark Industries from his dad, who is the one who built it up from the ground up and died when Tony was very, very young. And so, you know, all those fucking Iron Man movies have some scene where there's a, and I feel like there have been like a dozen different actors that have played Howard Stark over the years, whether in like Captain America flashbacks or anything like that. But it is this like constant presence in Tony's life is the legacy of his father, because that's part of what the first movie is about, is him deliberately trying to move away from Stark Industries as being this weapons manufacturing sort of war profiting company and make it something positive and sort of make it something his own. But it, and then obviously then Civil War comes in and makes that another really big part of his character, with Winter Soldier having been assassinated his parents. And so that element of something I would not have thought for them to bring up and focus so strongly for Tony, I did not imagine that, like, even when they started the time traveling stuff, it didn't occur to me that he would meet his own dad. But once that happens, it's so obviously the choice. Now that Tony has become a father himself, you need to resolve all of that baggage. And yeah, I'm with you that sequence and then what that builds in for then the ending of the movie with his sacrifice did hit me really hard, because like you, I've seen all these movies with my dad, because my dad is also, he's, you know, he bought all these comic books when he was a kid, and that's why I read the comic books and why I like the superhero stuff now. So we've seen all of these movies together, and there is like that quality of it, and the sort of the fatherhood and the passing on of the torch and all that kind of stuff is really powerful. And it's such a canny thing to do with Tony's character, because again, while that has always been a thing for him, generally speaking, I don't feel like it's been something really front and center in his movies the way that like the PTSD thing has been for the past few movies. Like, clearly, like, that's something they bring up here and kind of resolve here with this conflict with Thanos. It's a big part of his arc in Infinity War. It's what Iron Man 3 is about. It's what Avengers 2 is about. It's a big part of Civil War. Like, the PTSD from New York And Avengers 1 is a big part of his character, but they go for something even deeper at the roots of him from those the pre-Avengers movies as well.
And the scenes with him and his daughter in this movie,
yeah,
this is what I mean by, if you gave me the movie and said, cut this to 2 hours 20 minutes, be ruthless, you have to get it there, we'll pay you $10,000, you know, whatever, I could do it. But one of the things you'd probably have to cut is the stuff with the daughter, or some of it, you know, or some of the stuff with him and his dad in the middle. And that's the heart of the movie. I'm sorry. It's a pretty long scene with him at the lake house with his daughter. Pepper's there too, but it's more about him and, I think her name is Morgan, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Him and Morgan. And they're beautiful scenes. Robert Downey Jr. is so good in those, as showing, like, this is a Tony who, in the darkness of the world post-Infinity War, has found peace, and it is real, and it means something, and he has found, you know, I think that thing that is bigger than him that he's always been looking for since Iron Man 1, like the thing to fight for, and it is epitomized in this little person that he's, you know, had and raised and loves, and she loves him, and, you know, that's a big topic to broach, to have that be his motivation, and then at the end know that the choice is, she's never, you know, he is, his daughter is going to grow up without a father the way he did, but he has to do it, you know, and putting him in that position. And I think the maturity that signals on the behalf of this character, you know, I think it is both just, it is a good idea in execution, or in theory, but in execution, the way they pull it all off is incredibly impressive to me. And all credit to fucking Robert Downey Jr., man.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, just because one thing I do really like is how much that element does change who Tony is, of him not being this sort of lost, aloof person. Like, he's still cynical and snarky and funny in that way, but before the cynical, snarky quality of his character was always something that he used to push other people away. Even when he was being a hero, he was always kind of lost in his own personal relationships and could never really nail anything down with Pepper properly for anything that lasted more than one movie. And so then there's something about him having to, now that he has gained this and found that peace, for like the final test of heroism for him has to be, is he willing to give that up and sacrifice that for the greater good, which has always been kind of part of Tony's stance, is that, like, we have to do what's best for the greatest number of people. Like, that's his stance in Civil War, is like, we have to do what is best for everybody, not just like stand and be like stock still in our principles, no matter what they are. We have to see what is the best thing for everybody, and him having to make that sacrifice is the culmination of that quality of who he is. And it's made far more meaningful by him having something truly to sacrifice that's not just himself.
Yeah. There's that scene with Pepper early in the movie. It's probably like 45 minutes in. This is such a big movie. And I don't know about you, Sean. I had no sense of time while this movie was going by. I checked my phone twice, not out of boredom. I just was like, what time is it? I have no idea how long this movie has been on, in a good way. Like, I really just was into it. But, like, yeah, maybe 45 minutes in, where they're at the lake house. He's been asked by Cap to help with the time travel thing, and he doesn't want to do it. And I like what Pepper says to him of you know, like, because this has been a tension between them in other movies, is, like, how much he throws himself into Iron Man. But it's clear, like, if it's this pressing and he's really the only one who can do it, there is that responsibility. And I love that we go into this last movie with her and him on the same page about that, and even being encouraged. And the way that wraps up at the end with Pepper being there when he dies and what she chooses to say is beautiful and just perfectly done.
Yeah. And I'm glad that they didn't try to just redo the, like, Pepper's mad because he's trying to be hero thing. Like, which is such a, like, frustrating trope in this kind of fiction.
Yeah.
And it's fine, you know, it's fine in those earlier movies, but I was very relieved that they didn't have to replay that bit again. And then Pepper's just like, no, yeah, of course, Tony, like, you have to do, like, if you've invented time travel and can fix this shit, you have to do this because we got out lucky. Like, nobody else did. Everybody else got pretty fucked by this thing.
Yeah.
We have to fix that for them.
Yeah. It's really smart. One thing I also want to say, I love that they maintained the 5-year time jump in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, because I was really worried they were going to erase it and, like, get rid of Tony's daughter or something, and that would have been so horrible. It'll make it a little awkward in future movies. Like, there's going to have to be a line about, like, so Spider-Man's class, half of them are graduated, right? Like...
No, I mean, they all are. It's been 5 years. So for Peter, like, I'm so... This is something we'll have to readdress at the end, but I'm so fascinated by what the fuck they're going to do Spider-Man Far From Home to address the fact that anybody that was not zapped away is 5 years older. It's like...
Right.
I wonder if any movies are going to actually address that specifically. But yeah, I'm like you, I'm glad that they just maintain this weird 5 year gap. And
because it means the scars of the movie linger, and it means that it all mattered. They don't erase Infinity War, right?
Yeah.
It's a hard won battle, and this happened. It is history in the world. It, you know, not in a way that they probably can grapple with fully, because this would completely change everyone's understanding of the cosmos, but like it's there and it matters. But yeah, back to Tony. Just there's a lot of good stuff with him throughout this movie. The sequence in the middle, where I love that they narrow it down to the last part of the time travel stuff, is him and Cap, and just get Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. in a room and have them do one last mission together. When Tony reaches out his hand and Cap says, "I trust you," and they shake hands. Oh my God. You know, yeah. That's just one of those fucking great movie moments. And, you know, I love the way those two interact through the movie. His Tony's last confrontation with Thanos, it feels very fitting that even though, you know, Tony he's not super powered compared to the other Avengers. He's just a dude in a suit, but he is the last guy standing, because that's partially just who he is. And that moment when Doctor Strange, who Benedict fucking Cumberbatch in this movie, Sean, is so good. We'll get into that later. But he turns to Tony and he just raises his hand, and you see him make the number one, and then Tony nods. Oh my God, it's so good. And that piece of writing, "I am inevitable. I am Iron Man." Snap. Perfect.
So good. Yeah. It's... We'll get to discussing everything in that last battle later, but I think that's...
Oh, man.
That's good for Iron Man for now.
Yeah.
Who's the next person you want to talk about? Cap?
Just because, like, those are the two who are at the top of the call sheet on this one, clearly. Like, Thor is in that top upper tier, but I feel like he's just one notch below in this movie because he is still ongoing, you know?
Yeah.
Because Robert Downey Jr. is great. I love him. Chris Evans also. Just, we've always loved him in these movies, and he's so good in this. There's been some controversy I've noticed online over his ending, and whether or not people are totally into it. You know, what happens is he goes into the past to replace the Infinity Stones, winds up staying with Peggy Carter into the future. What did you think of Cap's ending?
I think it's perfect. Like, yes, I have not seen other reactions to it because I haven't really looked around to what other people are saying about Endgame. I think it's 100% abso-fucking-lutely perfect.
Yes.
And it's one of the things that... Like, again, it's so evident that the Russo brothers have such a powerful understanding of all these characters. But, like, Cap is their guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they obviously didn't make the first Captain America movie, but they made literally all the other ones.
Well, and we should also say, not just the Russos, but the screenwriters, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely.
Yeah.
They wrote Cap 1, 2, 3. They wrote Avengers 3, 4. They also did Thor the Dark World. Like,
there you go.
They are... the Marvel screenwriters. Like, they are so good at this, and I think they deserve so much credit, because these are well-written movies, I would say. Mm-hmm. And the writing is such a big task, and clearly, like, they get Cap. The Russos do too, but I don't want to forget them in this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, because the thing with Cap is he's a man out of time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's past the first movie, where in the first movie he just gets to have his fun World War II adventure and punch Nazis and everything. But past that point, he's a man who has lost everything. Like, again, it's kind of like with the Tony stuff with his parents. These movies don't spend a lot of time hammering that point home, because it's not the point of the movies, because they're big superhero action movies. But something that permeates everything about his character... And it's, you know, it's why he's so desperate to get Bucky back, is not just because Bucky was his best friend, but it's like, this is the one thing he can have. It's like, oh my God, like, it's not just Bucky. It's Bucky from that time. Like, he's not 90 years old or whatever in a fucking, you know, nursing home. This is Bucky. Like, and I have to hold on to that if I can, no matter what. And so, like, that element of him having lost everything and then also him being stuck in ice, like, it's, you know, it's sort of a little bit of a cliche, but when he's frozen out of the ice as a, like, his body is, his heart never is unfrozen. Like, who he is as a person is never unfrozen. He's never given the opportunity to change, which is part of who he is he's, you know, this, like, rock solid, like, I know who I am, I know what is right, I know what is wrong, and I will always stand for what I believe in. But I think if he had been left to his devices and had survived the events of Captain America 1, he's still a human being, and he would have moved on and changed and grown and had relationships and all that kind of stuff. But the fact that he's ripped from that moment in his history means he's never given the opportunity to change and grow up from that point. And he's constantly stuck as that one person. And that's, you know, one of the ongoing themes of his character in all these movies is that he is completely unyielding in every single thing he does, which is both a good thing in some circumstances and a bad thing in other circumstances. And it's like, you know, a cynical viewing of these movies is that Captain America is like, there's a lot of talk about Tony being responsible for a lot of the bad shit that happens, like with Ultron. Captain America is responsible for most of the bad shit that happens, because if Captain America had not been there, they probably would have just killed Vision in Infinity War.
Yes.
Like, he's the one who's like, let's not do that. And if Captain America hadn't been there, the Geneva Accord shit would have gone completely differently, and then probably everyone would be unified and would have been able to fight off Thanos. Like, Iron Man makes a completely valid point when he re-meets Captain Cap near the beginning of this movie. When he's like, most of this is kind of on you, asshole, because if we had listened to me, yeah, like, things wouldn't be perfect, but we would have been able to fight. And, like, we would have been able to stand up. We would have been able to be unified. But because Cap is the personification of he needs everything to be perfect, and it's that, you know, he allows the perfect to become the enemy of the good kind of thing, he's sort of partially responsible for everything that happens. And I think Cap is 100% aware of that, as everyone else is. And that's why he needs to move on. That's why, mm-hmm. at the end of this movie, the only way for him to move on is for him to go back to when he was frozen and live his life from that point. Like, it's either you kill him or he does that. And you already killed Tony. Tony gets to have the big heroic death. I think it's appropriate then for Cap to be able to live his life. That's the line he has. It's like, he's, you know, I finally got to live that life that everyone's been telling me about. Like, yeah, I think his ending is fucking perfect. What about you?
Soldiers get to go home. That mm-hmm. is part of, right? That is yeah. part of the contract. You get to go home and live a life. And that is who Captain America is. That's who Steve Rogers is he's a soldier at heart, right?
Yeah.
And so let me tell you about the complaints I've seen, because I've seen several. Some of these articles are fucking dumb. But, like, I have seen this online of, like, I'll get into some of the nitty-gritty of it. But the big one is just that people don't buy that Cap would lay down the shield and stop fighting, especially in the past when he knows that, like, S.H.I.E.L.D. is out there, or Hydra is out there overtaking S.H.I.E.L.D. and some of the stuff. And I would say, no, he fought the fight. He saved the world in World War II. He went in the ice for 70 years. He comes out. He saves the world, like, 7 different times. He got rid of Hydra S.H.I.E.L.D. He fixed all of that. He saved the world from Ultron. He saves the world from Thanos. The fight is over. Tony got rid of Thanos and his army. There are a bajillion other heroes out there, and that's part of his journey also, is letting go and giving it to the next generation, because I think Cap is the one who has the hardest time doing that, right? So he yeah. gives it on to Falcon, and he gets to go home. And that, to me, is powerful, because that is part of the social contract, you know, with armed forces, with people like Steve Rogers, is at the end of the day, hopefully you get to stop the fighting when you've won the war, if that is possible. And he did, and he gets to go home. And I think the final image of this phase of Marvel being him and Peggy finally getting to share that dance, perfect, beautiful. I love it so yeah. much. The other thing I've heard in terms of the criticism is that the time travel logic doesn't make full sense, to which I will say, one, time travel logic never makes full sense. It's yeah. time travel. It's a literal impossibility. So keep that in mind. And two, like, I actually think, when I started thinking about it, I think they've been planning this for a long time with Steve Rogers, because they conspicuously said several times, Peggy Carter has a family and kids. They never show us that family and kids. To me, it's just, yeah, the family was Steve Rogers, and Peggy is really good at keeping a secret because she's a badass, right?
Yeah, she's a spy. She's a secret agent. Like, it's literally her job to keep secrets.
Yes. So that makes sense. And then also people are like, isn't it icky with Sharon Carter then? Well, Sharon, they made very clear to tell us, Peggy is her aunt. So her and Steve would not be directly related in any way, if I understand the family tree there right.
Yeah.
So I feel like, if they had this all planned, I probably would never have had Steve actually kiss Sharon as he does in Civil War, but whatever. Like, I think it works just fine. There's the question of like, wouldn't Steve try to go like change everything in the past? Because he's like, no, I actually don't think he would, because again, he did fix all this eventually. The time travel logic is such that I don't even know how that would work out. But also, like, just let the man have his peace, you know? Just let him have it.
Yeah. Because I do... Because again, like, so much of this stuff in this movie is so thoughtful. I think one of my favorite bits in this movie is after you have that time jump and you see how, like, everybody else is, like, completely different. Like, everyone else has changed, like, physically. They've changed emotionally. They've changed in, like, every way you could think of a person to change. Except for Captain America is the same exact fucking dude. He looks the exact same. In fact, no, he looks the same. He's gone back to looking the way you've always known him to look.
Like, the
most that Captain America has ever deviated as a human being is he decided to grow a beard once. And, like, that's it. That's as far as he ever got. And he just, you know, he's counseling people. He's, like, going around and, like, he's, you know, sacrificing himself and doing, like, good stuff. And he's looking out for his friends. And it's like, he is the exact same fucking dude. And that's why he has to be able to move on and go back and live his life. Like, because, again, your choices are either to kill him or do what they did in this movie. Because you just can't keep on doing this to him. You can't just have him be around and be the same person forever. Because it's fucking sad. Like, it's tragic. It's like me saying that, like, he's the same dude is not like that good old Captain America. It's like, this is tragic for this human being to have lived for 5 years and never changed in any significant way. Like, that's not normal. And it's like, I'm very happy that Cap gets to have a happy ending and that he gets to go back. And like you said, it's paying off stuff that goes all the way back to his original movie from 10 fucking years ago. You know, it's really heartwarming. And then also, you know, I'm just also such a big fan of Sam Wilson / Anthony Mackie in these movies. So him being able to probably pass on the shield.
I was so happy when they did that.
And Chris Evans is really good as old man.
Yes.
Like, Clint Eastwood ass looking motherfucking old Captain America is so good. And it's like, I do want him to pop up once or twice in a future movie as old man Captain America. Not to, like, fight anybody, not for anything big. I want, like, someone to go, like, Spider-Man to visit him or something and have, like, a 3-minute conversation with old man Captain America. I want a couple of those scenes.
I want him, he's out on his porch, he is in a rocking chair, he has a glass of lemonade, and he doesn't have a book or anything. He is just happy, just being in the world. That is how Chris Evans is going to look at that age, right? Like, they nailed it. Or at the very least, it's how Steve Rogers would. Like, they had him aged. Like, even, like, the sweater he's wearing and everything. It's so good.
It's like he lets his New York accent come out a bit more, which is really a really sharp choice as an actor to be like, you know, once he's this old fucking New York motherfucker, it's really good.
It's so... And it's a beautifully written scene. It's beautifully performed, and... Yes, I think if I were making a wish list of things I wanted out of this movie, Sam Wilson getting the shield so he can be the next Cap was up there for me. And
they did
that so well. Because I love how they leverage some of the relationships in this movie. Like, when Tony dies, the first person there is Rhodes. And Rhodey doesn't really say anything because he doesn't need to. That's, like, the relationship they have, you know? And it's the same here when Cap is old and sitting on the bench. Winter Soldier doesn't go over there because Bucky gets it. You know, he doesn't need to have the conversation. He's like, no, you go, man. And Falcon, Sam Wilson goes and does it. And, you know, they know the characters so well. It works really beautifully.
Yep.
Thor.
Let's talk about my boy Thor.
What a journey Thor has been on, Sean, in these movies. Chris Hemsworth, like, we always knew Chris Hemsworth was perfect as Thor. That was never in doubt. But I think the depths of that performance, particularly the comedic depths that have been unveiled over the years, have been such a joyful surprise, and they go for something in this movie.
Yeah, this is the one that, like, I would have never in a million years actually seen this come. Like, I maybe would have come up with Big Lebowski Thor as, like, a joke. Never, ever would have thought they would have gone for it, but it's fucking perfect. Because Thor, because we've been talking about Tony and Cap as two characters that have, like, lost everything, and that's part of what defines them as heroes, is that, you know, Tony has lost his family and never really coped with that properly. But, you know, Cap lost everything when he got put into the ice and has never really coped with that. But Thor has never been that. Thor is always, like, jovial. Yeah, like, let's go, guys. Like, you know, I'm fucking the Prince of Asgard. I've got this big family. I've got all my friends. And it's like, you know, everybody loves Thor because Thor is the best. And he's this, like, happy guy that has all these really happy, fun relationships with people. He's, like, the opposite of an angsty hero. And they even give him, like, one of the most angsty superhero movies in the MCU, which is Thor Ragnarok, and he's still not angsty. He's still just, yes, like, a, fuck yeah, Hulk, let's go! Like, you know, because that's who he is. And so there's something really, really powerful about seeing him, you know, this 5 years later, from him having lost basically everything. There's, like, that tiny, tiny handful of Asgardians that have survived the events of Ragnarok and Infinity War that are just in some weird, like, beach town in Scotland or wherever the fuck they are. And he's, like, he sort of brought them there, let them be mostly autonomous, and then he's just, like, fuck it, man. Like, I'm kind of just done. And he just becomes, like, this weird alcoholic asshole living in this cabin with Korg and Meep or whatever that other dude's name is.
I love that they brought Korg back. Thank God.
So good. And just everything about it, because he continues to be the funniest character. They give him some just, like, incredibly funny bits to play. Everything with him screaming into the microphone at Noob Gamer 69 or whatever the fuck that dude's name was. It's just so... Taika Waititi must have written that bit. There's something that, like, I feel like they must have allowed him write that little tiny, like, pocket scene, because it's so Thor Ragnarok. But yeah, like, everything with that, it's very funny, but it's also so sad to see this guy. Like, he's still jovial because that's what he is. Like, he projects that joviality because that's who he is. But you can tell just how much he's suffered from all of this, and he's not someone that's used to that kind of emotional suffering, so he's the one who copes with it the worst of everybody. And that makes sense, and it's really sad to see.
When I was watching Infinity War last week before Endgame, I said on Twitter, my favorite scene in any Avengers movie might be where he comes to Wakanda through the Rainbow Bridge, and he lands, and Rocket is there, and Groot is there, and he raises his axe and goes, "Bring me Thanos!" And I love that moment so much. And in hindsight, like, because he loses, and Thor is used to having the big heroic moment where he lands and raises his axe or hammer and then goes and wins, but he emphatically lost that one, right?
Yeah.
And to the point where he killed Thanos and it didn't matter at the beginning of Endgame, it makes total sense that Thor would just be like, he has nothing left to live for, his people don't really need him anymore, the ones who are still there, he has no fight to fight, he's lost his whole family, he's just gonna become a fucking alcoholic, and they're gonna put Chris Hemsworth in the fat suit, which is so... I love that he never loses it. I love that at no point in the movie do they do, like, a training montage where he, like, loses the weight really quick or something. Like, it's hidden in the final scene, but he is still, like, the way they have to, like, braid his long beard and everything, it's so fucking good. Yeah, he just goes full Big Lebowski Thor, and it is both very funny and very poignant. And when we talk about themes of fatherhood, there's also the scene with his mother, so motherhood in that case, but just parenthood in general, that is, like, one of my favorite scenes in the MCU, is when he's back in the time of Thor the Dark World, which, hey, represent.
Fucking, yes, that's one of my happiest moments in this movie, is seeing that, like, of all the movies that they pick that they have to go back to, one of them gets to be Thor 2, and it just feels like this big double middle fingers to all the people that just hate that movie unfairly. It's like, I'm never going to say it's one of the best Marvel movies. It's better than anybody fucking gives it credit for. Fuck yeah, Thor 2.
I watched Spider-Man Homecoming last week. Better than that. Way better than that. I would easily go to the mat for that.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right.
Uh-huh. So anyway, Thor the Dark World is good. It's part of this movie. I love that. But they also, like, they bring Rene Russo in and have that scene with his mom, because I've always found that really touching in Thor 2, all the stuff with his mom. And it's just a beautiful scene with him. It really, I think, ties a lot of Thor's characterization together. And yeah, by the end of this movie, man, you know, Iron Man and Captain America have such resonant endings in this because it is like the end for them. But when you think of the totality of the journey, I'm not sure anyone's been on more of a journey in the Marvel Universe so far than Thor. From where we meet him in Thor 1 to where he is at the end of this movie, that dude has gone on a fucking journey.
Yeah, because I love that it starts with him. Like, his whole thing is that he wants to be king because he's the heir to the throne. And Odin knows that he's not worthy, so he tests him and sends him to Earth and all that stuff. And then eventually you get to, like, Thor Ragnarok, where it feels like he's you know, the journey of that movie is, by the end, he has sort of uncovered and sort of dealt with the underlying, like, sort of seedy underbelly of what Asgard is and how it came to be with all the colonialist themes, and then concludes with him understanding at last that it's not about a place, it's about a people. And it feels like that maybe makes him now worthy to actually lead his people, which is the note that movie kind of ends on. But I think it's pretty canny for these movies, Infinity War and Endgame, to come to the point for Thor that it's like, it feels like it honors everything he did in Thor Ragnarok, but it sort of puts him in this other spot where his, like, the true realization he needs is that he doesn't need to be king. And in fact, like, because I was thinking about these movies in relation to Ragnarok, and I think something interesting is the conclusion that Thor shouldn't be king feels even more appropriate to what Ragnarok was saying, because the only reason why Thor would be king is because he's the son of Odin. And it's like the monarchic, you know, ascendance of, or like line of succession. That's no reason to fucking pick a leader. Yeah, Thor is awesome. Thor is great. I love Thor. I would not want Thor running a fucking country. Like, that's not the dude I would, if you had the Asgardian democracy. I just don't, and like, depending on his opponent, who knows. Generally speaking, I don't think I'd put my vote in for Thor to, like, run our fucking, like, you know, foreign diplomacy or whatever. Valkyrie is probably the better choice. And him, like, passing off the torch to Valkyrie and saying, you are a leader. Like, this is not for me. Like, I'm going to go find, like, what's best for me in my life. There is no reason that I have to be the one to be king. I really like that as his conclusion. That's where he gets to leave off. And then go have fun rocking around the universe with the Guardians of the Galaxy. That's a fun fucking ending for him to be able to have.
Absolutely. I'll admit, in the theater, I felt a little, like, challenged by Thor's ending. Like, I was like, I don't know if that works for me. And I had to think about it, and this is why I know I like it, is I had to think about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I liked it. Because I totally agree with everything you just said, because I was worried, is this betraying the end of Ragnarok a little bit, where he really fully got to the position of being a leader? But to me, it's like, well, what was Thor's actual job? Was it to lead in peacetime, or was it to save his people? And he did that. He saved his people in Ragnarok. He did all the stuff you talked about of overcoming that colonial history of Asgard. In these last two movies, you know, he got everything back to where, like, they have a new home. They got everyone back who Thanos snapped away. They're okay. Thor's not a peacetime leader, right? He's been a man of war. He's the guy who fights. He's the guy you want leading the battle. But, like, what role would he have? Like, Asgard is on Earth. They're their own, like, little town. They don't really need a king. They need someone to, like, run the day-to-day stuff. And Valkyrie is clearly a much more responsible, put-together human being. So, yeah, I think it makes sense for Thor to finally say, like, you know what? I did everything I set out to do. They're fine. Now I can figure out who I am. And I think that's exciting. And more than anything to me, what it says is that this is a character Marvel's not done with, because I agree, like, not because anything was done wrong, but Iron Man and Cap, by the time you get to Endgame, it feels like we're ready to say goodbye. Like, their stories have come to their natural conclusion. When you get to the end of Thor Ragnarok, I don't know about you, Sean, I'm like, give me another Thor movie right fucking now. Do not let that be the last one. This is, you have, it's so good, you cannot let this go. And it's not just that Thor Ragnarok is good and that it's one of the best Marvel movies, it's that Thor does not feel finished as a character. He feels in progress. He still feels in progress in these movies. And it's not because they don't know what they're doing with him. It's because he's unexpectedly a really rich character. And I think that makes it stick. I love all of his stuff with Rocket Raccoon in these last two movies. In Endgame, all the stuff with them in Asgard is so great. It's Rocket running out of Natalie Portman's room with, like, the stone, and they're all the Asgardians are chasing him. That's fantastic. Him, you know, going back and forth with Peter Quill about being the Asgardians of the galaxy is fantastic. And just, like, there's so many possibilities. He could be a main character in Guardians 3. I'd love that. They could make another standalone movie, but just, it feels like almost kind of meta of, like, he's still in progress, and that's good. Let him be in progress, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm glad that they did not force a conclusion on him as a character, like, wholly in this movie, and, like, leave him for more stuff, because we've talked about it before on this podcast. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Thor is my favorite of these characters. He's so fucking good. Chris Hemsworth is amazing. He has all the best laughs in this movie come from him. That whole extended sequence at the end with him and Quill and, like who's the real leader. It's like, oh, yeah, no, it's you. Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. And it's just, his comic timing is fucking perfect. And that's one of my favorite things about these movies is this journey we've been on with Chris Hemsworth as an actor,
yep.
Where it feels like he just constantly was cast as just like big, handsome, dumb guy because that's sort of what he looks like. And then people slowly started realizing this dude is funny as shit, and then slowly ramping it up until it's like a full-on like pseudo-comedic performance at this point, and it just 100% works because he's so good at it.
Did you guys get the trailer in your theater for the new Men in Black?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That movie looks great. It's him and Tessa Thompson. I am down for that.
Yes, that's very good. Have you seen the version of that trailer without the music that got leaked online?
No, I heard that happened, but...
Yeah, so that's the first time I saw the trailer was that version, and then I got to see the actual trailer. It's much better with the music, but if people want to Google around to find that trailer for Men in Black International without the audio, it's not as good as the Tom Cruise Mummy one, because nothing will be as good as that, but it's still very funny to hear a trailer that does not have any audio, or other than it's only the dialogue, all the music and sound effects not exist.
Yeah. All right. So those are our big three. Thor, Cap, Iron Man. Rounding out the main six from Avengers 1, we would have Black Widow, Hawkeye, and
Hulk.
So let's talk Hulk.
Yes.
Did you see Professor Hulk coming? Because I didn't see Professor Hulk coming.
No, but it is so perfect. Like, it's so what they needed to do with that character. And it makes sense as a resolution to him being Hulk all the time in Ragnarok, him being Banner all the time in Infinity War. Now he's the fusion of the two. It's like, of course, that's what it needs to be.
Yeah. It's, for one, like, it's a testament to how much CGI has come, because one of the glaring flaws in Ang Lee's Hulk, among many, is that the CGI is just so bad you can't even look at it. In The Incredible Hulk, the Marvel movie, also very flawed, the CGI is better, but it's still not there. Then you get to Avengers by Joss Whedon, and I think it's really good, but there's still some work to do. By the time of Thor Ragnarok, it's great, and so much of Mark Ruffalo's performance shines through there, and he's really able to build a character out of the Hulk. And then, like, here, you can just have, like, photorealistic Hulk with Mark Ruffalo's face, and it's not uncanny at all. It just fucking works. That's really impressive to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just love seeing Hulk with, like, normal person clothes just walking around. It's so constantly funny to me every single time they show it in the movie. It's just like this is the Hulk with the t-shirt just walking around talking to people, and it's fucking amazing.
Oh, and I just love his personality. There's one of my favorite jokes in the movie is when Ant-Man is out in the outside and he's eating his taco, and then the Quinjet lands, and of course his taco gets thrown away, and then Hulk comes out because he's very thoughtful and gives him two more tacos.
Uh-huh.
And just Mark Ruffalo is so good in these, Sean. I mean, we're gonna say this about everyone because this is such a good cast, but like, I also just think it speaks to how good Mark Ruffalo is that this is all CGI. And you don't think about that. It's just like, yeah, Hulk's on set. He was walking around. Mark Ruffalo got hit with gamma radiation, and he became the Hulk, and he's on set. It's very seamless.
Yeah, and it's also so much to his credit that he's been able to build this character and do all of this without ever having a movie that was just his movie. He's only been in the Avengers movies and in Thor Ragnarok, and that's it. And he isn't even in all of the Avengers movies, so... Or I guess, well, he is in all the Avengers ones, but he's not in Civil War.
Right.
Which is basically just an Avengers movie. But yeah, so it's like the fact that he is able to sort of have pulled this whole performance without ever technically being like the lead character of any one movie is so impressive to me, like both for him and then for like the writers of being to sort of being able to architect this arc for the character across all these different movies. Must have been very difficult to organize, but they pulled it off perfectly. And it's, he's such just like a vital, fun presence. And particularly, I think it was very insightful of them to pair him with the Ancient One in the flashbacks, yes, or like the time travel sequence, because it's like such an interesting pair of characters to put together, and have him get, have like the literal out of body experience, which is, you know, what the Hulk is he's the separation of body and mind and all that. This, like, it's just a cool, a very cool, smart choice for them to do with him as a character.
I think, if anything, what this whole journey with Mark Ruffalo's Hulk has taught us is that Hulk probably works better outside of solo contexts, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I think, you know, the main reason, by the way, Marvel has never done another standalone Hulk is that they can't. Universal has the distribution rights, and Disney does not want to share their toys, so, like, it's never going to happen in the near future until Disney buys Universal, which we're joking about that now.
Yeah, it's a cut to 5 years later. Yeah, in America Endgame.
Yes. That's what the 2020 election is called, Sean.
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway, but yes, so that's the main reason it hasn't happened, but like, I'm glad it hasn't happened. I think Hulk movies are hard to do. I think a proper, like, modern day MCU, if they got an interesting director, could probably pull it off with Mark Ruffalo's Hulk. But I don't need it. Like, I think he's so interesting as a figure who kind of refracts off of all these other big personalities. It's worked so well. I have no regrets about that. The one thing you would say about his arc is that because he's been passed around so many, like, writers through these movies, is that there is some inconsistency here and there. Like, they really tried to push, or Joss Whedon did in Avengers Age of Ultron, the whole thing with him and Black Widow. I don't think him and Black Widow have a scene in this movie. And I think
they have like one look. They look, yes, at each other.
Yes. I think they made the right choice having this be Black Widow and Hawkeye in this movie and then Banner with other people, because I think the Black Widow Hawkeye relationship is much more interesting. I don't need Black Widow in a romance. I don't really need Hulk in a romance either. Like, I think some of that stuff is fine in Age of Ultron, but I just think it's better done here. I think they picked the right pairings to, like, finish those characters off with. But just in the back of my mind, once in a while, it, like, occurred to me, like, when they share that look, I'm like, oh, are they going to do anything with this? And they don't, and probably the right call.
Yeah, I agree. That like, was never felt like a strong choice in Avengers 2. And it's, like, particularly, I think, from Black Widow's side, like, I just don't. I've always actively wanted them not to do a romantic relationship with her, because I think it's too easy. And it would have probably just been a very boring choice and boring subplot.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they just sort of abandoned that in that movie, and they've never tried to do a Captain America Black Widow thing or a Hawkeye Black Widow thing. It's like, she's just friends with people, which is fine. The you know, you can have a female member of the team and she can just be friends with people. It's fine. Yes.
And I think Scarlett, getting into Black Widow and Hawkeye, Scarlett Johansson and Jeremy Renner are really good together in that vein, and it really makes me wish that instead of taking that turn to Black Widow and Hulk, I wish they had stuck with more of her and Hawkeye, because I really like that stuff. And yeah, I think it pays off really well here. The scene where, because this is the other big death in this movie, is Black Widow, and the scene where they're fighting to see which one of them is going to sacrifice themselves is very good, and it feels utterly in character that they would have to fight for the right to die. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's one of the scenes that I really love thinking about Endgame in, like, relationship to Infinity War, because, like, it's, you know, I think the movies are sort of paired in a couple of scenes in interesting ways, but that Soul Stone scene is, like, it's literally the same thing. You know, it's two people go to this island where weird Red Skull man is there. I know he's like the Red Skull. So it's the Red Skull is there, and he's like, oh, you must sacrifice. He has basically the same dialogue. It's like, you must sacrifice something you love, a soul for a soul, and all that shit. And in Infinity War, because we're following, you know, a monster, he takes the thing that he loves, but it's his twisted conception of love, and takes his adopted goddaughter Gamora and just throws her into the pit. It would have never occurred to Thanos to sacrifice himself and pass that power on to someone he could trust, because there's nobody he can trust because he's a monstrous asshole. And so this the comparison to this is what separates our characters from Thanos when they're seeking this kind of power is that it never occurred to Black Widow or Hawkeye to try to sacrifice the other person, because how would it ever occur to them? Like, they are like they are such good people. They literally have to fight each other so that they could for the right to sacrifice themselves. It's like, I'm not going to let you die. I'm not going to let you die. And they have to fight each other that way. I like the way that those two scenes talk to each other and show the difference of what sacrifice meant to a villain like Thanos and what sacrifice means to heroes like Black Widow and Hawkeye.
I agree, yeah. And I think playing off of... And this is what I mean by I wish there had been a little more with them in past movies, of they both have a lot of guilt about their pasts. Black Widow for all of her work maybe before she met the Avengers. Hawkeye for everything where he is Ronin, which, by the way... The scene where he is in Japan doing his cool fight and they do it all in one take, that's really good.
It's very good. Scene. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, like, I think that interplay is really interesting. I had no idea until Scarlett Johansson finally falls who they were actually going to pull the trigger on. I thought it was probably going to be Hawkeye, because there is a Black Widow movie in principal photography right now. But they kill Black Widow. She is dead. They make a point of that at the end of the movie. The Hulk says, "I couldn't bring her back. I'm sorry." Were you surprised? What did you think about who they chose to off there?
Yeah, like, because I was with you during that sequence, I could not tell who was going to die, because it's like, because both characters make sense in different ways. Hawkeye makes sense because in that 5-year gap, instead of choosing to, you know, become a hero and lead the heroes, which is what Black Widow does, she chooses to effectively become the leader of the Avengers, and because Tony's gone off and started family. Instead of doing that and joining the good guys, Hawkeye decided, well, I'm just going to start murdering all the bad people. He basically just becomes like Sword Punisher. And so him deciding, I'm not worth it, like, because I decided to abandon all that stuff. Like, it's not like I'm the one who should die. That makes sense. But also, he's fighting for his family and to reclaim the stuff that he lost in Black Widow. She doesn't have, like, her family is the Avengers, and she doesn't have anything else outside of that. And so it makes sense from that perspective that I can 100% see why she would be so eager to sacrifice herself in comparison to Hawkeye, because she knows that Hawkeye has so much to gain that Black Widow just really doesn't have. Like, what she would gain is the ability to keep on doing what she's been doing all along. So it makes sense to me, and I think they could have honestly done it with either character. I think one of the reasons probably why they went with Black Widow is because Tony dies at the end of the movie, and leaving like the family behind thing, doing that with both Tony and Hawkeye probably would have felt slightly redundant. Like, I think it would have hit a very similar emotional beat again, and Black Widow sacrifice herself gets to have a different version of sacrifice be played on screen.
I agree, and I also just think it makes, ultimately, it feels truer to me from the characters that Black Widow would be the one who wins that fight and fights hardest for it. Because one, we've just seen her in action. And two, she is very straightforward, very logical. Hawkeye has 3 kids who need a dad. You know, like that's... And I think she's very empathetic, and she, you know, loves the people who she fights for. I think she would do that. I just, you know, do. And I think Hawkeye was completely ready to die for them. But, you know, I think it makes the most sense. And who knows what this Black Widow movie is. I hope it's a prequel of some kind, because I would be weird to reverse that, you know. And I'm not sure.
I mean, I've always assumed that if they made a Black Widow movie, it would at least be in part a prequel. Like, the most it would be is, like, further in the timeline would be she'd have to deal with something from her past, because they've just never done anything with her past in these movies. They've always hinted at it. But that's in the comic books. Like, I'm not a big Black Widow person, but that's mostly what I know of her from the comics, is her constantly trying to fight things, like threats that come from her past as an assassin, that come back, to haunt what's happening in today's world. Like, I assume that's what some sort of Black Widow movie would be. And honestly, they could just set it in like 2014 or something. Like, they could just set it whenever they want. I assume they're not going to bring her back, because that would be weird.
Yes. Because that is the thing. This movie generally plays for keeps. Like, we do, everyone who gets snapped by Thanos comes back, but, like, Gamora, is the Gamora who died is dead, and they don't bring her back. There's a new Gamora, which I think is very interesting, and that's something worth talking about later, but, like, you know, and then also there's possibly an out with Loki, because he steals the Tesseract, but we don't know where that's going. But, like, generally the people we saw die, die. That doesn't change in this movie. And I found that interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right, so those are the main six from the original Avengers. There's a bajillion other fucking characters we could talk about. I mean, is there anyone else in particular from the cast in this one? Like, Ant-Man, I guess, is a major one here.
Yeah, there's Ant-Man. Let's talk about Nebula, because she's a pretty significant part of this movie.
Unexpectedly so.
Yeah, because it is, you know, most of the Guardians characters are snapped away at the end of the last movie. You just have Rocket, who he gets to be paired off with Thor. But then we have Nebula, who has, like, very quietly in the background of these movies started to become one of my favorite characters, because she's, like, in Guardians 1, I kind of found her a little bit of a tedious character, because I don't think they focused on her that much. But I bet if I went back and watched it, I would enjoy her character in that movie a lot more than I did at the time. But, like, the slow sort of, like, development of this character as, you know, just, like, what if Gamora stayed evil is kind of what she always felt like to me. And turning it more into this character who is, like, you know, an abuse victim, and, like, a very, like, within the way that all the Guardians characters are, but, like, to the extreme with Nebula, that she's a character that has never been able to escape her abuse until she starts to in these movies. In Infinity War and Endgame, you kind of see her push the boundaries of that more and more. And there's something really interesting about her role as this sort of, like, pseudo anti-hero on the team, and this character that, like, nobody else really knows her, but she's still willing to stick around and fight for this stuff because she's finally started to sort of, again, break out of that shell and become a hero. There's something very interesting about that arc for her, sort of in that, it's the same Hulk way, where she's never been the star of anything, but in the background, they've been pushing her in this direction all along, and she plays a much more pivotal role in this movie than I think anyone would have thought.
It's part of the magic trick of these movies, which is, if we're just getting down to brass tacks, what is the reason Nebula is there? It's that the plot mechanics kind of need her there, because she is the one who alerts Thanos to the time travel shenanigans, right? And then she's, because they can easily replace her, because she is this weird, like, robot person, she's able to get into the future and call Thanos and his army in. So that's why they need her. But you don't think about that while watching, because she's very well written. Like, the hand that's playing the trick on you is very convincing about that, right? Here, and I think it's that, one, Karen Gillan is just very good in the role. Two, I think the writing on her has been very consistent throughout all of her films, and it's just gotten better over time. And I love the thematic reverse here, which is that she gets to do for Gamora what Gamora did for her.
Yeah.
Is really touching, and we'll talk about this, I'm not 100% sold on everything they do with Gamora in these two movies, just because, like, it's such a big thing to do out of the hands of a Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and out of the hands of, like, James Gunn and that main, like, cast and crew family. But I think everything they do with Nebula across these two movies makes me really excited to see her in the next one.
Yeah, and it feels really appropriate that at the end of this movie, she is on the ship with all the other Guardians, and Thor is there, and that they're all going off together. Like, it makes me excited to see, eventually, when we get Guardians 3 with James Gunn, like, with her being, like, a member of the crew with everybody else. Like, that's a cool place to leave that character. Like, if there's one thing I would have actually liked to have seen more in this movie, is I would have liked to have one more scene with her and Tony on the ship together. Because the idea of those two stuck on the ship, like, you have that one really good scene where they're playing paper football together. But other than that, you don't really get anything with them interacting with each other. I would have liked to see a little bit more of, like, a montage or time lapse of them interacting with each other a little bit more. Because the idea of those two stuck on that ship for, like, a month or whatever is hilarious to me. And would have just been interesting to see. And then again, like, then later in the movie to have, like, pay off that relationship in some way with them meeting again after the 5-year time gap. I would have liked to see a little bit more of that. But this movie is stuffed to the gills with so much shit. It needs to do that. I want 100%. Like, I bet that there is some of that in, like, on the cutting room floor somewhere, because it makes a lot of sense to do that. And I'm guessing, you know, people lost their shit for whatever reason about this being a 3-hour long movie. They probably were like, well, fuck it, we'll get we'll not do that bit because people are going to go weird if it's like a 3-hour, 10-minute long movie.
Well, it's also that's the very beginning, and you've got to get, like, the first 15 minutes of this are very tight in that you've got to accomplish so much with Tony getting back to Earth and the Avengers going into space and confronting Thanos, and that has to feel like a setup, not the first act of the movie that then restarts, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, because you do kind of restart the clock on this movie when you get to the title, and I think it's the right length. I do think if you added anything there, it would fuck up the pace, but I would be happy to watch those as deleted scenes on the DVD.
Sure.
Yeah. So, all right, so we have Nebula. Rocket Raccoon, I don't know if there's anything more to say other than we love Rocket. Bradley Cooper is great. Sean Gunn is great doing the mocap. And I love that there's more of him in Thor. And we did get, not a ton of it, but we did get Tony Stark and Rocket Raccoon working on something together. And that was fun.
Yes, yeah. He's just a fun character to bounce off of other people. Like, he doesn't have any big character work or development really in this movie much. But he does have that one scene, like that one little moment when Nebula comes back, like they at the beginning of the movie, and he goes and like sits down and holds her hand.
Yeah.
I found that very touching.
Very touching. Rocket is one of the best characters. So good.
Yes.
Ant-Man is unexpectedly pivotal to this film. I love all the stuff with him. Paul Rudd is just great, and he's really good in this team-up context like we saw in Civil War. But just the whole thing where he comes out of the, what is it called? The mini zone? What is it?
The quantum realm.
Yeah.
Quantum realm?
Yeah. I wanted to call it like the mini zone or something, but that's not it. But yes, or I think I was trying to come up with Minus World, which is the glitch from Super Mario Bros.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's in the quantum realm. He comes out in the storage unit. He goes and finds his daughter. That's like, they're going to have to deal with that in a future Ant-Man movie, that his daughter aged 5 years without him.
Yeah, like, I found that, like, really, because it was that thing where once he knocks on the door, like, I realized immediately what they were going to do, and I'm like, oh, you motherfuckers, like, yeah. That's so good.
It is.
It's, yeah, it's like, of course you have to do that. Of course his daughter aged 5 years in this time span, and he meets his adult, like, her teenage daughter. Yeah, that's fucking, it's, because the stuff with his daughter is some of the best stuff in the Ant-Man movies.
Yeah.
I found that scene very touching.
It is, and that'll be interesting to do in the next one. But then we also, so much of the plot of this movie relies on all the Hank Pym stuff, where you have, it's the Ant-Man suits, and it's the Quantum Realm, and they need their Pym particles, and all of that. You even get young Michael Douglas again in this. It's, who would have thunk that Ant-Man would be so fucking pivotal to the universe?
Yeah, it is that thing where it's like, what this movie needs to do is so complicated that it feels like the Russo brothers and the screenwriters just like had to dump all the toys out onto the floor and be like, how the fuck do we do this? Like, what do we put together to make this make sense? Like, what are all the concepts that have been established that we can put together for these Avengers movies? And yeah, like, it feels appropriate that somehow Ant-Man becomes very pivotal, and not just him as a character. All the expanded Ant-Man lore becomes very pivotal in this movie to, like, okay, right, Pym particles, and you shrink down really small, and in the quantum realm, time works differently, which we saw, like, in Ant-Man and the Wasp, like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Fuck it.
I mean, it's the magic trick of Endgame is that I don't think you need to have seen every Marvel movie to enjoy this film. But if you have seen every Marvel movie, they will reward you for every Marvel movie you have seen. Like, I don't think there's a single one, other than maybe Incredible Hulk, that is not like, well, even there, William Hurt is in this as, not William Hurt, am I right? No, yeah, William Hurt.
I think it's William Hurt. He plays Thunderbolt Ross.
Yeah, Thunderbolt Ross. So yes, even Incredible Hulk, that dude's in here. So, like, all 21 movies before this, there's something from them that matters in Endgame. That's so impressive to me. That's like a really, and none of it feels forced either. Like, it's usually like just naturally bringing it in.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's good. And like the scene where Ant-Man is like going around the like monuments to and trying to find all the names, like all that stuff's just really well done.
And we get another giant man at the end when he just bursts out of the compound when it's ruined.
Yeah.
And he has the people in his hand that he saved from, like, the sewers. That's a good moment.
Yeah, Ant-Man continues to have, like, the most fun superpowers of any character in these movies. Other than maybe Doctor Strange is the only one who competes with him for cool superpowers to watch.
Yes. So sticking with characters who were not snapped away, because I think we can do a piece later on just everyone who comes back at the end. But is there anyone else from the main cast? I mean, you have... Okay, we should probably say Captain Marvel is in this.
Yeah.
not a ton. I think she was well used, but like this was not clearly not the movie where like Brie Larson as Carol Danvers becomes part of the team. It's really her there for her powers more than anything.
Yeah, that's another thing that it would have been nice to see a little bit more of her, but it makes sense that like this movie is so focused on all the characters that we already have been with for so long that it would have been hard to put her into a lot of this movie without her feeling a little bit out of place just because she's only had one movie. Mm-hmm. Like even Ant-Man at least has the crossover with Civil War, so everyone knows him already. And then also she is so much more powerful than everybody else that at some point she trivializes a lot of things by just being there. So I like the couple of times that they're like, she's like, no guys, you don't get it. Like you're fighting on Earth and that's cool. And I respect that. I'm fighting in like the galaxy. Like I'm flying around and I'm doing Super Saiyan shit. Like that's cool. Like you're doing Krillin stuff on Earth. That's fine. I'm doing Super Saiyan shit. So it's like, you know, I'm busy.
Yes. She's definitely a Deus Ex Machina in this movie in that she's the thing that saves Tony and Nebula, and then she's the thing that wipes out Thanos' ship at the end, and she almost beats Thanos himself. I mean, Brie Larson does get a very good moment where Thanos tries to like headbutt her, and she's just like, yeah, bitch, that didn't do anything. That's, yeah. She's very good. I also love her like four different haircuts in this.
Yes. Yeah, giving her like the modern sort of Captain Marvel shortcut is very good. It's a good look for her.
Absolutely.
And it's nice to see because that's like, because I've always really loved that redesign for Carol Danvers. They did in the comics where they gave her like that really short sort of military cut. And it's good to see that Brie Larson looks really good with that haircut. So, two thumbs up.
All good stuff there. I think that's pretty much everyone in the main cast of this movie, right?
Yep. I mean, there's probably like five fucking characters we're not thinking of.
Of course.
But yeah.
And I mean, there's all the like guest stars, like, you know, John Slattery is Howard. There's been two Howard Starks so far that are significant. Like, there's a lot of like one-offs, but like you have John Slattery usually plays the older one and Dominic Cooper has played the younger one. And so this time it was older Howard Stark. That one they could have kind of gone either way, but they went with John Slattery, which is good because John Slattery is the one in Iron Man 2 where
yes.
Tony is watching the videos from him. And so I think that was good. And John Slattery is very good. Michael Douglas has a couple of moments and he's funny. Peggy Carter is in here in a couple of shots, but is not a huge character in it. But, you know, I like that all these people were game to come back, even if it's just for like a scene or two.
Yeah, I think my favorite example of characters that were brought back for like one scene for like the time travel shit is all the elevator people from Captain America 2. And like sort of like the minor villains and then just the assorted henchmen. And it's just the same people like that. Doing that callback was very fun. And yeah, like I like all the it feels like they basically employed half of Hollywood in this movie. Like there's a ridiculous number of different actors that have had like one-off roles in some of these movies that come back for something in this.
I think it's amazing they got Robert Redford in this for that one
yes.
scene.
Because
Robert Redford is retired. This will be his last movie credit. It's not the last movie he shot, but his last movie credit will be Avengers Endgame. Robert Redford did not predict that when he started in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But yeah,
fuck, he surely didn't predict that when he played that character in fucking Winter Soldier.
No.
like 8 years ago or however long it's been.
Yes. Like, can we talk about all the time travel stuff?
Yeah, okay, let's do that.
I love it. I love it so much.
It's very good.
You and I are particularly disposed to time travel bullshit. We love
yes,
it.
I mean, this is the most Stephen Moffat superhero movie that has been made since Stephen Moffat wrote his superhero episode of Doctor Who.
Absolutely, it is. It's full time travel bullshit. I love it. I love that it allows them to pay homage to all these different Avengers movies. They get to do the Back to the Future 2 thing of going back to settings we already know. And I think all of the different time periods are fun. There's like the thing where they're on Morag and Chris Pratt is doing the dance, but we see it without the music. Is fantastic.
That's such a good bit. It's just like, oh, so he's just an idiot.
Yes. It's great. Yeah. But I think the stuff in New York is probably, like, I think the stuff in the past with Steve and Tony is the most, like, emotionally affecting. But in terms of exciting use of time travel mechanics, I think the entire way they blend in new set pieces into the New York set piece from Joss Whedon's Avengers is really cool. And I love all of that.
Yeah. And I just love, like, particularly just getting to see, like the dove, like in dumb detail, all the shit that happens immediately after they beat Loki.
Yes.
And because in the movie, you know, you just have the big, the great, like, fuck off shot with everyone. Like, it's like that low angle shot, everyone aiming at Loki, being like, we kicked your ass, blah, blah, blah. And then you just get to see, like, okay, guys, let's get it, put him in cuffs. All right, yeah, let's grab the scepter. Do you here put this in the briefcase? And like everyone just started cleaning up, and Loki's just standing there and like making fun of people, and he turns into Captain America for a second. Like that's such a smart use of that, of just seeing like it basically feels like what happened behind the scenes of that fight. Like here's like all the like dumb paperwork that gets to be filed after they win. That's a really smart way of sort of integrating that without doing like too much of a Back to the Future 2, like, I have to, like we're seeing the full scenes. I like that it's mostly just what are the little bits that happen after the scenes that we know.
The best stuff is with Hulk. Just Hulk, uh-huh. They won't let him take the elevator. He goes down the stairs, and that is what fucks up Tony's whole plan to get the Tesseract, is Hulk runs, I was like, Hulk, hate the stairs! And he hits Tony Stark. Oh,
Tony's his own worst enemy, because he's the one that made fun of Hulk and said, you have to take the stairs.
He is.
So, you know, that's the, like, Tony reaps what he sows.
It is
even across the decades.
It's a karma in a very roundabout way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, we get Steve Rogers fighting himself as Captain America, which, that's a good fight sequence, and it is dumb, and I love it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you have to have one of the heroes fight themselves. Like, that's just, you know, superhero time travel 1-on-1. You gotta do it. I like the little, like, running gag of people looking at Cap's ass, and then Cap getting that line, and it's like, you know what? That is America's ass.
That got applause in my theater.
Yep. It's very true.
I also loved, yes, as you say, the whole scene on the elevator is great, and that moment where he leans in and goes, Hail Hydra, one, A+, fuck you to Marvel Comics and their whole arc where he became a Hydra agent, and two, just, I love Chris Evans getting to, like, do it and say the words is so fun.
Yeah, because it just feels so skeevy. Like, it feels dirty to hear Captain America say that, but it feels dirty in a good way.
Yes, because like, he's doing it for the right reasons, you know?
Yes, yeah, he's doing it to trick those assholes.
Well, because they're so easy to trick. That's what's funny, is that was really easy getting that scepter.
Yes, yeah. Maybe just having, like, this one two-word passcode that everybody in Hydra uses with each other, that everybody who knows anything about Hydra knows, maybe not the most secure way of identifying who's on your side.
Yes.
Just saying.
So, all of that's great. As you said, the whole thing with Hulk and the Ancient One, I did not expect Tilda Swinton to be in this.
They've employed half of Hollywood. Anybody who was anybody in any of these movies shows up for something in this film.
Yes, even Natalie Portman refused to come back to shoot new stuff, so they just put in a deleted scene from Thor the Dark World. That's where she's from in this, which I love. But yeah, Tilda Swinton's actually really good in that scene. I mean, she's good in everything, but like it's a much more meaty scene than a lot of these cameos are, and I had fun with that.
Yeah, it was just fun. It was such a good performance from Doctor Strange that it's fun to see her again, and you know, it's convenient to have her because she gets to do, like, get the good visual to explain the time travel in the movie, which I'm very glad that apparently Marvel Cinematic Universe time travel works on the same rules that Dragon Ball time travel works, which is, like, the most direct parallel I can think of for the time travel they talk about. Because it's like, okay, yeah, so you go back in the past, but it's not going to fix anything in the future because you're actually creating a split timeline. They probably should look out for some Kais coming in and fucking shit up eventually, and maybe Beerus will destroy the universe. If eventually, when Disney buys, you know, Disney already owns Dragon Ball Evolutions. Eventually, when they buy the rest of Dragon Ball, when they buy everything that exists, then we'll get to have, you know, Trunks fight time-traveling Captain America or something dumb happen.
Yes. Sean, do you agree with me? Dragon Ball time travel logic is easily the most sound and defensible time travel logic in any piece of fiction?
Oh, absolutely. Like, the just insistence of you do, like, time traveling to the past doesn't change anything in the future. It's like, okay, you fixed everything about time travel. Like, it's just, no, you're just creating new different timelines. Okay, perfect. Fine. Yes, I get it. It makes perfect fucking sense.
It has the least amount of time travel logical problems.
Yes.
So, anyway, yes, that's all great. Yeah, anything else from New York? That's such just a fun, playful sequence. I am curious where they're going with, because they never follow up on Loki escaping with the Tesseract.
Yeah, that does feel to me like some sort of out, since they've announced that they're going to work on that TV show for the Disney Plus stuff with Loki.
Yeah.
That feels like, I suspect that's how it is. Although they could honestly, like, Loki could have survived the events of Infinity War, and they could justify that because it's fucking Loki. He survives anything and everything if you want him to.
Yeah.
Like, I would rather he that have been his death, because I think it's really powerful in that movie, but, you know, they can do what they want with that character.
Yes. So we'll see where... And it was good to have Tom Hiddleston in this one also, because
yeah.
What's an Avengers movie without Tom Hiddleston? It's Age of Ultron. It's not the best Avengers movie.
Exactly.
So there you go. All right, so all the time travel stuff. Then you have the stuff in the 70s where we talk about Tony and his dad and all that. I do like the scenes with Captain America there, too, like especially where he sees Peggy and just it kind of sparks what's going to happen later in the film.
Yeah.
Very good. And then the last act of this movie, Sean. Fucking
yeah.
Madness. I had no idea this movie was going to go as big as it does. And I don't know why I didn't predict that, but like they go for it.
Yeah, because it was especially after they kill Thanos early in the movie, it was this like open question of like, then what the fuck happens at the end of this movie then? Like, if Thanos is dead, what is like the final battle that people are going to have to fight? And so, yeah, having Thanos start finding out about what's going on because, you know, Nebula's memory is shared because she's a cyborg, and him being like, well, shit, I guess this is what I'm doing now. Like, okay, I guess I succeeded, and then I died. So let's just go forward in the future and do it again. There's something very appropriate about that. And yeah, like, it's just, it was fun to get some more of those scenes with Thanos and be like, yeah, Thanos is a good fucking villain.
Yeah.
It's satisfying to watch Thanos both succeed as a villain in a bad way, but then it is particularly satisfying to watch people kick the shit out of Thanos in this movie. So yeah. All that stuff. I was very surprised to when they started to do the Thanos, like 2014, like Guardians of the Galaxy Thanos, and start bringing him forward. It was like, okay, that's an interesting way to get around that problem of how do you finish this movie?
Absolutely. So we'll talk about the finale in a minute because it is one of the most out of body experiences I've ever had in a theater. But first, I made a tweet about something when I saw this movie where I said, Avengers Endgame has a lot of similarities to a Harry Potter fanfic I wrote once but never published.
Okay, yeah, I remember this tweet. I remember being very confused by it.
I assume a lot of our anyone else who follows me was too. Should I explain what I mean by that?
Yes, please. Please enlighten me.
Okay.
What was this Harry Potter fanfic and how does it relate to Avengers Endgame?
I had this... Sometimes I just come up with stories and write them down and they're not for anyone, you know. Everyone does this, right?
Yes, yeah.
So I did this with Harry Potter once. This was probably 5 or 6 years ago. Like, I thought about it for a while. It was actually also pre-Cursed Child, the play they did out of Harry Potter, which also stole some of my fanfic. I'm kidding, they didn't steal it.
I mean, I'm pretty sure J.K. Rowling personally broke into your home, went onto your hard drive and copied all your Harry Potter fanfic.
Yeah, no.
And so, yeah, so I'm sure you already know what's going to happen in Fantastic Beasts 3.
Yes. Sean, if I did, I wouldn't have seen Fantastic Beasts 2. anyway, but... So I never wrote the whole thing because it would have been like book length, but I have a very like detailed outline for it. And the story is set for Harry Potter. It's set like in the, I don't think it's all the way caught up to where like book 7 ends with Harry and his friends in the future, but it's like Harry Potter as an adult, he's working at the Ministry of Magic, all that stuff. And in the plot of my like fanfic story, somebody breaks, one of like Voldemort's old followers breaks into the Ministry of Magic to like steal their time travel equipment, which you have in book 3. And what he's doing is trying to create an opening for Voldemort to escape from the past before he is defeated and come into the future and invade it. And this is kind of the plot and a bunch happens with that. And when I realized they were going with that, I'm like, it was a weird out of body experience for me just being like, That's the plot of my Harry Potter fanfic, but they're doing it with Thanos. And it was sort of surreal for me because, like, to be frank, a lot of Infinity War and Endgame are so big and silly and nutso, they feel a little fanficky, but in a good way, like in the fun, like playing with toys, knocking them together way. So that was where it was going with it. I think in the story I wrote, what ends up happening is Harry gets sent into the past, and like it's also very much like a Back to the Future 2 style thing, and I think it's set during book 5, and then he and Voldemort have this duel, and he has to like erase his memory and all this stuff. Anyway, if you want to read more about that, feel free to DM me, but that is my stupid Harry Potter fanfic that related to Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, it's also This is minor spoilers for Sekiro, but it's not, without any context, it's not going to make any sense, so I'm fine with saying it. It is also weirdly similar in a weird, in a very weird way to something that happens at the end of Sekiro, that will only, like, people who have finished that game will know what that means when I say that. But it was when I was, when that started happening, I had this as like, there's something that did something kind of like this, and it took me like a full day to realize, right, okay, it's similar, it's like, it's different, but it's kind of like what they do at the end of, say, okay, that's weird. That's weird that those two things happen very close to each other.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So it's just fun aside there, but yes, Hulk is the one who snaps the gauntlet. What did you think about that?
I mean, yeah, it works. Yep. It's good. I like Big Hulk. I like Smart Hulk. And I like the logic of him being like, yo guys, I'm the fucking Hulk. And Thanos kicked my ass. So I'm pretty sure that this gauntlet would just obliterate all of you. Let me do it.
Well, and there's also the line about how most of this is gamma radiation. I was born to do this. I like that kind of payoff with the gamma radiation stuff. So that's all very good. And then the battle that happens after that, man, when... I mean, one, let's start. There's kind of two phases, because there's the battle against Thanos with Thor, Captain America, and Iron Man. And I love that it's those three, like the original three MCU heroes on the battlefield with Thanos. That is such a good fight. Oh my God, when Captain America gets Mjolnir. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ. That is as hard as I have ever applauded in a movie.
I mean, yeah, because it's like, because, you know, that has happened in the comic books, and it's fucking amazing when it happened in the comic books. But yeah, seeing that happen in the movie, and especially then, because it's not just that, like, it's Captain America using Mjolnir. It's the stuff he does with it. Yes. And the shield together that's the coolest thing that has ever been put to film. That's just like the choreography of having a magic shield that can absorb all... energy, basically, and then like a magical hammer that can shoot lightning and you can throw it and summon it back to you. Putting those two pieces together in the hands of Captain America is the best thing since sliced bread. It's just
so good.
Fucking holy fucking shit.
Because that
like, I just want some gifts. I just want a bunch of high quality gifts from that fight because he does some really cool shit.
Because that sequence is good enough already without it, you know? Like, because one, Thor's whole look when he's ready for battle with, like, he looks like a fucking dwarf from Lord of the Rings with his beard style is great, and he's got both the axe and the hammer, and he's ready for battle, and all of that is great. But when the chips are down and everyone's worried, and Cap and Mjolnir starts to move, like, Mjolnir's got a mind of its own, and Cap catches it, and Thor goes, I knew it! And that payoff to the joke in Age of Ultron where Cap is able to move it just a little bit. Sean, I was just about on my feet cheering.
It was amazing. Because it was the kind of thing that, you know, I had had that realization probably sometime after Infinity War. That's like, they still have to do that. Like, they're definitely going to do that. But I had completely forgotten that was something to expect in, like, the heat of the moment.
And I had no idea that this was a thing in the comics. So it totally blew. I never knew that was a possibility.
Yeah, it was just so... Especially... Because I should have caught it when he got Mjolnir from the past and brought it into the future, which was like oh, that's cool. That's a cool way to that makes sense that you'd get Mjolnir back that way. But especially him, it was very smart of to use that opportunity to also have him drop the line like, oh, I'm still worthy, to sort of trigger in the audience like, right, that like the whole hammer thing is only those who are worthy can wield the power of Thor. And yeah, like set that up for then Captain America using the hammer and then doing the dopest shit in the world with it.
So good. And then I also love when he goes into the past at the end to like drop off all the Infinity Stones. He's just holding Mjolnir like he's holding a briefcase at an airport checkout line.
Yeah.
And it really makes me wonder, what do you think Cap did? Do you think he put all the Infinity Stones back while wielding Mjolnir? Or did he do Mjolnir first so he wouldn't have to carry it around?
I like the idea of time-traveling Captain America going through history with his shield and Mjolnir kicking ass to put all the stones back. Like, that just sounds like that's like they should make that miniseries on the Disney Plus channel or whatever, because I just want to see that fucking shit. But yeah, like, all that is so good. Because also I was thinking, like Captain America using that hammer kind of makes Thor look like a chump. Because Thor has always had that hammer. Thor has never done anything nearly as cool with that hammer as Captain America does in this movie.
Captain America definitely gets all my favorite action stuff in this film because he gets the fight with himself. He gets the fight against Thanos here. Because then the fight, Iron Man and Thor kind of go down for the count. And then it's just Cap and Thanos, and the way Thanos is, like, ripping away at the shield, and you realize that they're creating the vision Tony had in Age of Ultron, where they're all, like, dying on the battlefield. And then Cap, you know, getting up one last time, and that moment where he tightens the belt on his arm for the shield and just gets ready to die against Thanos. God, I love Chris Evans. I love Captain America. It's so good.
It's amazing, yeah, and I'm glad that since they gave Tony, like, the last moment in the fight with Thanos, like, mm-hmm. ultimately, I'm glad that we got this big mano-a-mano yes. with Cap and Thanos, because you just didn't get much of that in Infinity War. You just get, like, he kind of gets slapped around by Thanos a little bit, but doesn't really get to fight him.
No.
So it was nice to finally get the, like, yes, I want to see Captain America slap Thanos around for a little bit, get some solid hits in.
It's so good, and then the portals start opening, and Doctor Strange and all the sorcerers just bring through all of our resurrected heroes, the full armies of Wakanda, the full army of Asgard, Valkyrie on her fucking unicorn, which we didn't even know she had from the last movie, because she had it, but she didn't have it at the end of Ragnarok.
Yeah.
She got that back somehow. That's pretty awesome. And then I said Cap getting the hammer was the hardest I've ever cheered. I'm probably lying, though, because when Steve Rogers, Chris Evans gets to stand up and everyone is there, the entire MCU is there in one shot, and for the first time, he finally gets to say the words, Avengers
assemble.
Oh my God, I could have died right then and been happy, Sean. It is so good.
It's amazing, and it's like just that. You know, not since Gandalf, you know, marshaled at Helm's Deep to save the day has there been a, like, battle scene as, like, uplifting as that shot of all the portals opening up and people coming through. And just seeing all the, you know, all the people that we very tragically saw melt away at the end of the last movie, like Black Panther and Spider-Man, get to come back. It's like, fucking yes, fucking awesome. And yeah, and then you proceed to have, like, what is one of the most impressive, massive battle scenes I've ever seen in a yes. movie.
But
like, it I think handily beats out what they did with Wakanda in Infinity War, and it's just really fucking amazing.
And I love the stuff in Wakanda in Infinity War, but this is, I agree, because it's just full on. But before we do, I just want to hold on. How long have they known they wanted to do this with the words Avengers Assemble? Because they've been really careful about never saying it. You know?
Yes.
And yeah. There is something so, like, Kevin Feige must have had this in mind, and he's just cackling in his office thinking about, like, when they're finally going to use the line. Because they don't, they almost say it in the first movie with Samuel L. Jackson, but they cut away. And then there's the I love this ending of Age of Ultron where it's Cap goes Avengers, and then cut to credits, and then finally we get it. It's so much more satisfying than if they had said it, like, 50 times.
Yes, yeah, and just holding off for until, like, truly we have assembled everybody.
Yes.
We've assembled, like, 20 fucking something superheroes and then, like, a million other dudes that are, like, superhero affiliated. Yeah.
So good. All right. But yes, the battle itself, it's, you know, it's not as long, I think, as the battle in Wakanda or as complicated just with, like, the different fields of action. But there is just, I think, one, there's just the sense of finality to it in that the stones are on the field. This is the you know, they have gotten everyone back. This is truly the last chance. Thanos is going to wipe out all of existence if he gets the gauntlet this time. And everybody is there. Like, in the Wakanda battle, there were a lot of heroes off in space. It was kind of a two-tiered battle going on with Thanos. So now it is just everyone is together. Pretty much everyone in the entire MCU gets a big moment, whether they're a major character or not. Like, there's moments like when they arrange all the female heroes behind Captain Marvel and have them all rush together, and that's just a great tableau shot. I think the Russo brothers are not credited enough with how good they are at this multi-tiered giant chaotic action approach, because in Winter Soldier, Civil War, Infinity War, and this one in Endgame, their action is clear, coherent, understandable, but also really imaginative and creative and fun. Mm-hmm. That is hard. I think people sometimes put these movies down because it's true. The Russo brothers movies are not the most visually interesting films. I'm not sure they can be with how much is going on, but that is not the only part of making a good movie. And I think the feat of direction in pulling these movies off with the pace and the clarity and the confidence and the creativity they have is nuts. I mean, just look at fucking Justice League if you want to see how badly this can go south and just be CGI soup. That is not what Endgame is at all. They deserve a lot more credit than they get.
Yeah, because we've seen lots and lots and lots of superhero movies that have the, like, ending fight, and it's just kind of nonsense. And, like, almost basically all the DC ones, at least all the ones that I have seen, have that quality to them. Other than, I guess, Man of Steel is the only one that doesn't. Because Batman v Superman's big last fight with Doomsday is boring and practically incomprehensible. It's like the one, like, it's the only major flaw with Wonder Woman as a movie is, like, the last action sequence in that movie is bad and kind of dark and incomprehensible.
Aquaman is better at this, and I think James Wan is someone to look out for on this front. But we knew James Wan was good at that kind of thing anyway, so, like, yeah.
Yeah. And then Justice League is, like, the worst of all of those, but it all, because, partially because it has the most, and it has way more to juggle than Batman v Superman or Wonder Woman does. But what Justice League has to coordinate in terms of its last fight scene seems like the simplest, like gunman on gunman end of a Western ending compared to the shit that Avengers Endgame needs to do. Like, the moving parts and characters that Avengers Endgame has to, like, showcase and pull off is mind-boggling. Like, I just, like, I can't even imagine what the planning documentation looks like for putting this sequence together, and blending all the CG and the actual actors and all that stuff together and planning all the sequences. Because it's, you're right, it's not as long as the Wakanda stuff. And it's certainly, if you combine the Wakanda stuff with the, like, Tony and everyone fighting Thanos on Titan stuff, which is what those two scenes are intercut with, it's nowhere near as long as that. But it, like, has so much that it needs to chew, and so much it needs to convey, and it does it with such clarity, and gives every single character some moment, and makes it feel like the fight is always constantly progressing and evolving to different stages. And one of the things, like, the key choices and smartest choices they make with that is having the gauntlet with the stones be the centerpiece of the fight. And it's like, here we have, like, this football that we need to protect. Like, we have this, like, if Thanos gets this, we fucking lose. We have to keep this safe. And it centers everything around the fight over who has the gauntlet right now. How do we keep them safe? How do we move it to someone else? And, like, that's such a smart way to center the fight while also being able to showcase all the other shit that's going on at the same time.
Absolutely. I usually hate with a passion the line some people use about movie critics where it's like, well, you know, if you didn't like this, why don't you go make a movie, right? That's a stupid thing to say. This is the one case where when people are like, oh, yeah, Avengers, you know, this is, they could be more visually into, but fuck off, you go make this movie. That's really how I feel, is like, look at how much is on screen. Think about how much it, like, affects audiences. Like, these movies are so good at playing an audience, you know? You try it. Like, I can't even begin to imagine the filmmaking challenge. Like, that these movies are borderline competent is an achievement. That they are, I think, quite a bit above that is a real achievement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that of all of their, like, in-set piece fights, outside of maybe, like, the fight on Titan with Thanos, which is gets to be a bit more focused because it's a smaller group of heroes against one character, that's probably their most visually interesting fight. But I do think this one in Endgame does have some really spectacular shots and, like big, as you say, kind of like tableau sequences where particularly I feel like when Thanos' armies come down, there's something way more effective to me about the way it looks versus the Wakanda stuff where it's like it looks fine in Infinity War, but I don't feel like they communicate the kind of the horror of like the weird like sort of menagerie of different creatures that Thanos has sort of enslaved to fight for him. Whereas here, there's something like borderline Lovecraftian about seeing the giant worms from the Avengers 1 and all of that come down. And there's because the, you know, they just get to go full on like apocalyptic Earth look for it this time around. It just conveys the desperation of everything so much more powerfully to me, and it makes the like the enemy that they have to grapple with at the end of this movie feel like truly overwhelming in a way that I don't feel like the just like the color palette and the stylings of the, these kinds of scenes in the other movies don't fully convey, because other movies have like it's like full daytime, like bright sunny day in Avengers and Infinity War. Here it's like it was a bright sunny day and then hell came on Earth and it is not sunny anymore and everything is blown up and destroyed and on fire and we have hell worms descending from like the soot clouds above us. Like there's something really cool to me about the way that that sequence looks.
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that this does not end up as incomprehensible CGI soup a la anything Zack Snyder's directed is amazing. And it's so cool. It's so fun. You get all the Spider-Man is used very well throughout this. I love having Peter Parker back, but my boy, Doctor Strange. I like the Doctor Strange movie a lot. After these two Avengers movies, Benedict Cumberbatch has jumped way up the queue for me as like one of my absolute favorite movie heroes. He is so good in these Avengers movies.
Yeah, like he is one of the best parts of Infinity War for sure. And he doesn't have as nearly as much stuff to do in this because obviously he only comes back at the very end. But the little stuff he gets to do is so cool. And they just, the Russo brothers, it feels like, you know, they have so many ideas of what to do with his magic in these kinds of action sequences.
Yes.
That it's always just really cool to see, okay, what the fuck is he going to do now? Okay, yeah, he's going to make a giant fucking spiraling water death tornado. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, because I think, you know, I think I respond to him better in these than I did in the actual Doctor Strange movie, because in the Doctor Strange movie, which is a fun movie, I like it, but he is, it's an origin story, he's the guy who is learning, he's coming into this role. In these films, he gets to be Stephen Strange, Sorcerer Supreme, and he is the guy who knows everything. He is wiser, smarter than every other character. He sees into the future, and so he's getting to play the full-on crazy Stephen Strange, you know, sorcerer role, and he is so good at it. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch is so good at, like, projecting that wisdom and that just weird, slightly detached mysticism and everything. It's a blast. I love his little exchanges with Tony here, where Tony asks, you know, is this, you said you saw 14 million, you know, showdowns. Is this the one where we win? He says, if I tell you, it won't happen. And then going down to him making the number one with his hand and nodding at Tony. This is the most I've ever liked Benedict Cumberbatch in anything. And I love Benedict Cumberbatch. He's good in a lot of stuff. I think he's truly exquisite in these two movies.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something that it makes me excited to see a Doctor Strange 2 for what you said of like you only at the very end of Doctor Strange do you get that sense of like, okay, he has come into his own and his face down with Dormammu as you know is
love it.
Before is also like the most Stephen Moffat thing in any of these movies. That he's really good in that scene at the end of that movie where he gets to be full confident Sorcerer Supreme. Getting another Doctor Strange movie where he gets to be fully in that mode in his own movie is very enticing.
Absolutely. Because also, the costume and how much Benedict Cumberbatch commits to the dumb hand movements and everything. He's so good. All right. And we get Spider-Man back, and all the other heroes are there. I think War Machine Rhodes has a lot of good little moments in this movie, even though he's not the focus of anything. Yeah, I mean, there's literally at some point so many heroes, we're not going to be able to talk about all of them, but
yeah. Like Falcon, I love, you know, Falcon is one of the first heroes to come through. He flies in through the portal.
Well, because that's how they do it, is Cap hears in his mic, like, Cap, you there?
Yeah,
and you're hearing Anthony Mackie, and it's like, oh, what's going on? And it's great. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, that fight scene is incredible. That moment of all the heroes assembling will be remembered for a long time.
Yep.
As just like, you know, when we're talking about this big communal experience of watching these movies, like that is a truly stunning payoff for all these different characters they've built up for so long. But especially the payoff for this movie that is the most satisfying is this sense of Like, we have lived, like, us in the real world have lived in this world where Thanos won for, like, a year. And there's something about the way that they planned that out of, we're going to make Thanos fucking win that first movie, kill off, like, half of our characters, and a lot of the ones that are some of people's favorites, like Spidey, and just sit on it, have everyone sit on it for a fucking year. And, like, the amount of investment that that builds up in the audience to then see, let's now kick this fucking guy's ass, like, let's just beat the fuck up out of Thanos, is such a powerful feeling because we've been living with him having been the victor for such a long time now.
I also think you can't ignore that Marvel got weirdly lucky in the world being such a shitty dumpster fire this last year. Because there is also something cathartic about, okay, we had to live with that in our fictional world. The real world sucks. The Avengers got a do-over. We're probably not going to be able to do this against Trump, you know, where we go back in time and fucking fight him on the battlefield, although that'd be pretty great. I'd love to have Chris Evans just, you know, knock him in the face with Mjolnir. But I don't know. Like, I think maybe we'll talk later about just the utterly astonishing success of this movie and how much money it's made. I think part of it is just, like, I think there's a real desire because of the way the world is to see... It's escapism, but I think it's also, like, there's something very real about the kind of escapism and why we need it right now in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a moment where we desperately need good to triumph over evil,
yes,
right? We need heroes to exist and for them to be able to win, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and having, like, that simulated in the way that these two movies are structured is really powerful, and then it makes, you know, going in and watching, like, Captain Marvel swoop in and just kind of slap Thanos around very, very fun.
Yes, absolutely. Now we're going to play the game, Sean, where we try to assign one of the MCU heroes to each of the Democratic candidates for president. I'm kidding.
Oh, God.
Are there Democratic candidates now or more MCU heroes? I think there's more Democratic candidates.
There might be now. There's too many. Yeah.
All right. That actually could be a fun game, but we're not going to play it today.
No.
Anyway, yeah, it's great. Ending with Tony doing the snap and Thanos disappearing. Yeah. I love that also Thanos' last moment is this, like, long, lingering shot on him, and he doesn't say anything. Like,
yeah,
the guy who loves to talk and preach is finally out of words because he just fucking lost. And that's great. And then... yeah, we coming back around to the beginning of our conversation, everything with Tony's death and funeral and that amazing long take they do at his funeral on the by the lake, where they somehow did it where they got every actor in the MCU together in one location. Because I assume a lot of the battle stuff, they could have fudged it with green screen. Looked like everyone was there. It's one big take. They're all dressed up, standing there. We go all the way back, and we even have Nick Fury walk out for one moment. You know, it's a really powerful moment, and it feels very earned, not just in the sense of these 11 movies, or these 11 years of movies, but then also what is bringing them all together in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a really powerful, really powerful sequence. Like, if there's, again, thinking back to some of the things that, again, this movie is chock full of shit, so it's understandable why there's not this scene in here. I do wish that we had had one last scene with Nick Fury and Tony Stark together. Even just, like, briefly in the fight, if Nick had been there, because there is something that felt a little bit missing, because, you know, that's what started this whole thing off, was that post-credits scene to Iron Man 1 where Nick Fury shows up. I kind of wish that we got one little last moment with them, that at least we have Nick Fury at the funeral, just sort of watching over it all.
And I think there is something kind of poignant, though, about Sam Jackson in the back of the room watching it over it all, and that what I was thinking there is that, like, he's the guy who started all of this. He kind of pushed them together. And by the end, he didn't even have to be there. Tony was the man he believed in. And he didn't need any pushing from Nick Fury to be the guy who made the right call at the end. You know? There's something very poignant about that. Jon Favreau, also, I just want to praise him again. The scene with Happy Hogan and Morgan and him talking about hamburgers is such a beautiful little scene.
Yeah,
and I'm glad that he's still... I'm really glad that Jon Favreau is just willing to just come back for these movies and be an actor now that he is, like, one of Hollywood's most successful directors, and may set some more box office records later this summer with The Lion King. I love that he's willing to do that. I love that we're going to get him in Spider-Man Far From Home. all of that. So
yeah.
Gwyneth Paltrow at the end of this movie was fantastic in her couple little moments. Do you think they should have done anything more to recognize also that Tony was not the only hero who died in this, considering Black Widow died?
Yeah, like you get how you have that little moment with Hulk at the end when he talks about, I tried to bring her back and it didn't work. Like you have a little bit of recognition of her, but yeah, you don't have like the funeral. Like, I do think it would have been nice to have a little extra something for her at the end of the movie. But again, like there's part of it is that the Iron Man's death is both like literal in the movie, but it's also symbolic because he was the first hero in this cycle. So it makes sense that so much weight is put on him because again, it's a little bit meta as well, like his funeral.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything to say just about the cumulative effect of this journey that, you know, you and I have reviewed most of these movies on the podcast. We've seen all of them. We've talked about all of them together at length, I know, on and off the air. You know, just the restoration of Robert Downey Jr.'s career over these 11 years and everything he did with that role. Same with Chris Evans, who his character isn't dead, but he's clearly done with Cap now. It's been a hell of a thing to watch unfold and to bring it to this very, very satisfying conclusion, even if there's going to be more in the future. I just never expected it would come this far. Even sitting in the theater watching the first Avengers, the Joss Whedon one, just imagining that this could be on the horizon was out of the question at some point.
Well, I mean, let me frame it this way for you, Jonathan. When I distinctly remember us talking to each other about Iron Man 1 in 2008 in the hallways of the original Golden High School building, which has since been torn down and replaced because it was replaced after our first year at that high school. I distinctly remember that. I am now teaching freshmen in high school. That is what has happened in between over the course of MCU, as I remember talking to you about it. When we were freshmen, I am now teaching freshmen in high school. So that's how long it has been. That's how much has happened. We have had all of high school, graduated high school, had all of college, graduated college. I now basically have a teaching license and I'm teaching high schoolers.
I've moved to like another state.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
So, and it's weird for me to think about. For them, they have basically always lived in this world where superhero movies have been this really big thing and not something like for us that was like really hit or miss when we were kids. Of like you had X-Men, which was pretty good, and you had Spider-Man, which is pretty good. You also had like Daredevil, which was not pretty good. Or you had, you know, like a Batman and Robin, which is a little bit before that era, but basically the same thing. And you know, it was this thing where being into superheroes and liking superheroes when we were very young was still a fairly like niche thing that was a marker for you being like a nerd, when being a nerd meant being like a little bit of a social outcast. And now that's just completely different. And I can, you know, I mean, I literally did like earlier this year use Infinity War as an example of how protagonist in a story doesn't have to necessarily be hero. Like it is whoever is pushing the story forward, and arguably Thanos is the protagonist of Infinity War. I can make that reference and I can be pretty damn sure that basically everyone in that classroom is going to understand it. Even for the few of them that have not seen that movie, they know what that movie is enough to be able to use that as a reference point. Like that's absurd to me. Like it is absurd to think back to me being a kid and having to like, and me not knowing like if it was okay for me to tell some people that I like to read superhero comic books because they might try to make fun of me for it, and go from that to this movie made what, like $350 million so far?
Domestic,
right?
Yeah. It's already
domestically.
It broke a billion worldwide in one weekend.
Yes. Yeah. Like that gap in how much our culture has changed in relation to how we view and understand superheroes is seismic in a way that I would have never been able to predict. And it's really cool to see. It's cool to see that like these characters fundamentally work, because the reason why these movies have succeeded where so many superhero movies have not is because they understand who the characters are. And again, even if some of the other elements of the movie, like in Iron Man 2, is not an amazing film on it in its own right, I would still watch Iron Man 2 right now because it's so much fun to see Robert Downey Jr. play Tony Stark in that movie. And the characters are so fundamentally fascinating and such interesting portrayals of different facets of humanity that as long as you can replicate that chemistry that was created on the comic book page in the 60s, if you can replicate that with actors and directors and writers now on film, it's still going to work like magic because that's what is perfect about this world and these people. And it's just so cool to me to see that evolution happen and for me to be able to stand up in front of a classroom and talk about Iron Man and have people understand what that is, because you could not have done that when we were in like middle school before that Iron Man movie came out and fucking nobody knew who Iron Man was. Nobody had any idea. There'd be like two people and they'd be like nerdy and have almost no friends, and they would be the only people who knew what Iron Man was, and they would be the only other person they knew to talk about Iron Man with, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't say any of that better myself. I mean, pick any person who's been watching the MCU from the beginning, and 11 years is a long time in a person's life. You know, they're all going to have seismic changes. You know, you and I were just talking about ours and the journey like we've been on, but everyone has something like that with these movies, and I think that's why the reactions to Endgame are so genuine, and I think really worthy of like thinking about and not dismissing the way snarky people on Twitter do. Like, it's cool that this is a movie that a lot of people are going to and kind of crying at, because Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man has just been there in our lives for 11 years through a lot of turmoil. It's been a constant. The world has changed. Our lives have changed. Everybody changes in that amount of time. And to have these movies having been there along the way and been, you know, just a source of fun and of comfort and sometimes of inspiration has been really cool and really impactful. And getting to this moment where they can give that character a rousing heroic death and really stick to their guns on it and stick that landing, it's no small thing. You know, Kevin Feige, I think, deserves a hell of a lot of praise. If you want to know what the role of a producer is, think about Kevin Feige on these 22 Marvel movies where he is the sole credited producer on most of them. And that is like as a producerial like vision that is really out there and crazy that he was able to pull this off over these films and bring in so many interesting hires as directors and actors and writers and get to this point. You know, it's a lot of vision and then it's a lot of follow through. And yeah, it's hard to even talk about. And I think it's going to be hard to explain to people in the future who weren't here for this, like what this was like these 10 years of having these movies, the good, the bad, whatever they were, like it built to something really special. And I think it was really special along the way.
Yeah, because it is like, you know, like I said, I see all these movies with my dad, so I'd never go to any like the midnight screenings or anything like that, even when it would have been feasible with my schedule. So typically I see these movies with my dad and we go watch them on like Saturday from at like 11 or something, which is not a time where you expect there to be a lot of people at the movie theater. This is the most crowded movie theater I have seen in literal years. I think the last time I'd seen it, because the movie theater was basically full. The last time I saw this was, I mean, I guess there's been like special things like Dragon Ball Super Broly was a full theater because it was a weird limited screening.
Right.
I had to drive like 30 miles to get to that fucking movie theater, right? So like other than little special things like that or like Shin Godzilla, I think I probably have to go all the way back to Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, which I did see not that opening night, but like the immediate day after, because I was sick and I didn't go to school. Like I was legitimately sick. I did not just skip out on school, but I was sick as, and so my
sick
dad
enough
like,
to skip out on Star Wars, which is different than skipping out on school.
Yeah. And so my dad's like, hey, like you're home from school. Like, let's go see that Star Wars movie today instead of tomorrow. It's like, yeah, let's go. And we had to like wait in a line and all this shit to go see that movie. That's the last time I can think I was in a movie, like a general movie theater that was this crowded. And it was crazy. Like, it was crazy to walk into a movie theater at, like, 11:30 on a Saturday and have the movie theater be completely full. And people were cheering. People clapped at the end. People never fucking clap at the end of movies in Colorado unless you're, like, on the opening night. And, you know, people were, like, shouting stuff during the movie. When the best one was when Thor kills Thanos at the beginning of the movie, there's just one, like, what sounded like probably like an 8-year-old boy up near the front just went, "Yes!" And it's just like, and everyone just like laughed and clapped at that. Because it is just like everyone is so invested in this world, in these characters. And, you know, again, I have seen literally every single one of these movies in the movie theater except for Incredible Hulk, and I'm not sure if that one fully counts or not. So I've got to just continue with I have seen all of these in the movie theater on opening weekend at the very least. And I've never had this experience at any of them, even including Infinity War. And there's something weird, like interesting about this one. They have managed to sort of create so much momentum that coming into this, like, more people are going to see this movie in the movie theater than saw Infinity War, which feels weird because I feel like the logic is normally the other way. Usually it's like you have the biggest on like the first one, and then like in the sequel it drops off a little bit because, you know, anybody who watched the first one and didn't like it aren't going to go see the next one, but anyone who didn't see the first one is probably not going to see the second one in the movie theater. And this one is just like, nope, fucking everybody has gone and saw this movie. Because you have to. Like, it's just an essential part of our current culture. And that's cool that we can still do that. That's cool that that can still be a thing. Even if that gives, you know, countless more money to an evil monopoly, they would get all that money anyway. So at least it's for something that I think is fun.
Absolutely. Like, you've already got the enthusiasm police out on Twitter being like, don't be excited about lots of people seeing Endgame because it's Disney and they're blah, 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 because there's just people on Twitter whose entire goal in life is to make sure nobody ever has a good time with anything, no matter what. And, you know, I get it on some level that, like, yes, Disney, obviously, evil multinational corporation with way too much monopolistic power. I don't think, like, but I also don't buy, like, people are saying, like, and the only reason it's doing this well is because Disney, like, released it all at once and bought out every theater screen and that. It's like, but they couldn't have done that if people didn't like the movies along the way. Like, yeah. Disney is very powerful. They are not, and no company is powerful enough yet to make you like something just because they want you to like it and make the money. My proof for this is Justice League.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I guarantee you, if WB had the magical power apparently corporations have to make people go to the movies no matter what, Justice League would not have bombed as spectacularly as it did. Avengers Endgame is able to do what it did because I think they built this up, people genuinely like it, are excited about it, and it genuinely became a cultural thing. And I don't think you can discount that just because the money is going to Disney. Like, you know, money goes to corporations we find shady literally every day.
Yeah, there is no such thing as ethical consumption under capitalism. Like, no matter what you buy, your money is going to something bad. Even if you're just paying your taxes, your money is going to the worst shit. So, you know,
yeah.
Accept it.
Yeah. So, like, fuck it. I think it's cool. Like, the reason I'm into box office numbers isn't because I'm really excited that Alan Horn at Disney is going to be able to, you know, buy another yacht. Like, that's not what makes me excited. It's like, shit, a lot of people went to see a movie, you know? And, like, because the other argument I see is that, like, oh, the more we get of this, the more it's killing the experience of smaller movies in theaters. But that already happened, and that's not Disney. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to tell you that, but, like, that is, one, the rise of TV and streaming and just TV becoming higher quality and then streaming coming in and becoming the marketplace for a lot of that. Like, that's really... And yes, it's partially like companies like Disney stopped making those kinds of movies, but partially it's just because the consumer demand went in another direction. The bigger reason also is that movie theaters are increasingly shitty, they're increasingly expensive, and it's increasingly become kind of a thing you do on a special occasion. So, like, this is the ultimate example of that. This was everybody's special occasion. I think it's cool that that can happen. You know, everyone keeps predicting the death of the theatrical experience. I'm sorry, if you want it, go enjoy it. It's there right now.
Yeah, and, you know, film is still changing and evolving as an art form.
Yeah.
Like, this is another incarnation of what it can be, and that doesn't mean that you can't also have something like Roma come out on Netflix or whatever.
Yeah. And I think,
you know, that too is a movie. Too is a movie.
Absolutely, because I get the feeling from some of the enthusiasm police on Twitter that, like, they think that if it weren't for Avengers, Roma would have made $350 million at the box office this weekend. Like, I don't really think one is taking away from the other. Like, yes, in the year 1975, Roma would have opened and probably done pretty well at the domestic box office. But, like, the world has changed so fucking dramatically in every way when it comes to movies and distribution, and there is no one single cause that, like, it's weird to be mad at Avengers because Alfonso Cuarón got to make his dream project and make a masterpiece and everyone got to saw it. Like, what's the actual downside of that at the end of the day is that Roma didn't, I guess, play in as many theaters as we would have liked. It's still out there. I just taught it to my students last week, and it's pretty cool that they could all go home and watch it if they wanted to. I don't know. Mm-hmm. We're getting off topic, but yeah. One last thing I want to say about Endgame, if there's any other stray thoughts. Alan Silvestri's score for this movie is fantastic. And I think in both this and Infinity War, he does so much heavy lifting, making this big, sprawling narrative cohere. And I think he really does that in Endgame. It's a fantastic score.
Yeah, for something that is typically very poor in these Marvel movies, like Alan Silvestri's, wait, he's done three of them now, because it's Avengers, Infinity War, and this one, right?
He also did Captain America, the first Avenger, which is why you hear those themes in this movie, which I was very happy to hear, because I like that score a lot.
Yeah. So, like, his are basically the best scores outside of, like, Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther are the only other ones I can think of that, like, are in that same space. But yeah, like, he really helps make these movies gel together and feel like this is what the soundscape of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is to me, is his scores for these two movies. And it's something that it's frustrating that it's not a more universally, like, strong part of these films, like, but it's something that has been getting better. But it does feel like, even if it's not something that they've been building up in every single individual movie, his work is strong enough and has been seeded enough that it has, like, this very powerful impact in this film once everything starts coming together.
Yeah. And then I guess the last question is, where do you think Marvel goes from here? We've got Spider-Man next, and then we actually don't know what the next movie is after Spider-Man. It's not until next year. We know some that are, like, in the development pipeline, but they've very much played the cards close to their vest, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, so, like, you know, first with Spider-Man 2, or Spider-Man Far From Home, I do really like that little tiny scene you get, because you get, like, a bunch of little tiny vignettes at the end of Endgame showing a bunch of the characters, like, where they are at the end of that movie, and I like seeing Peter go back to high school, and it's just being like what am I doing here? And then he looks over, and Ned is there, and there's something weird about, like, it's really heartwarming, like, yeah, like, Peter and Ned both got disintegrated at the end of the last movie, so they get to be friends still in high school, as opposed to, you know, them being separated by 5 years distance. It was just like, I don't know how I feel about, like, yeah, you both horribly died and disintegrated, and now both of you have experienced the bitter taste of death, but you can still be friends.
Well, and based on the trailer from Far From Home, I guess
everybody did,
which, yeah. I mean, that is the thing. There's a way in which you would have to take that really seriously, that literally half of the population has experienced death and come back from it, and, like, there's no way you could have normal stories from here on out. I think we'll be able to move on with it, but, like, it is a crazy thing hanging over these films.
Yeah. So it's one thing I'm really curious to see in what way Spider-Man Far From Home addresses it, because it has to address it in some way.
Yeah.
It can't just ignore it completely, because that's never been the philosophy of these Marvel movies. Like, they typically don't have a thing that happens in movie A completely dominate movie B or whatever, unless they are direct sequels like these two. But they typically at least, you know, like Spider-Man Homecoming at least references the fact that Civil War happened and Captain America is, like, supposed to be, like, an enemy of the state or whatever by the time of that movie. Like, they reference it. So I'm curious to see how they reference it, because I feel like the results of this movie are far more wide-reaching and personal than the results of something like Civil War, which you can frame as, like, that's something that's happening, like, out there in the world, and it's a major news item, but it's not something that's going to really affect the lives of the average high schooler, that they're going to notice how it affects them. This is, like, literally everybody else we know has, like, graduated high school and is in college or has a job or something, and we are all still, all of us that know together the bitter pain of death, we are still in high school and everyone else has moved on. Like, that's such there's such a fascinating story to be told about that experience. But two, I don't know if that's the movie that I want to see as the sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming, a movie I genuinely enjoy. I don't know if I want the sequel to that movie have to, like, be dominated completely by that. So I'm very curious to see what their approach will be, how they reference it, to what extent they reference it. And if there are any characters from Spider-Man Homecoming that did move on. Like, I wonder if there's going to be, like, one small character from that movie that, like, is like a, hey, this is me 5 years later. Like, I'm now, you know, like, I'm now, like, a substitute teacher or something at school. You know, this has been 5 years. Like, shit happens to people.
Yes.
I'm curious to see, like, whether for Spider-Man or for other movies, how that comes up.
Because I think Spider-Man is the one that's going to have the toughest job addressing this, because Black Panther, I think you've got to reference it in Black Panther 2, but overall, like, they all agreed that T'Challa was king. He comes back, he'll still be king, right? Like, that's...
Yeah.
And Asgard fought in it, so, like... Or not Asgard. Wakanda fought in the war, so they all know that, and I think we could move on. Captain Marvel 2, it's not going to really be a factor in that, because she's out in space anyway. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, they're going to have to deal with Gamora, but, like, time on Earth doesn't matter out in space to the Guardians. And I'm trying to think of any other on... Like, Doctor Strange, I don't think it would present an issue for Doctor Strange. Are there any other active series they have going on right now where this would be an issue?
I'm not sure, because, again, like, part of this movie is them wiping some of the slate clean
yeah.
in a way that, like... I'm very excited to see what other new superheroes they're going to bring up to, like, start off some of this, like, fully new phase of the universe. Because, as you say, there's a couple, like, Doctor Strange... Ant-Man feels like he's still probably an ongoing concern. Captain Marvel, for sure.
Ant-Man will have to deal with it, but honestly, that's a boon for Ant-Man, because there's so many jokes you could do with this. Like,
yes.
Michael Peña's character, if he had to have lived, and then he gets to tell the story of what it was like for those 5 years in one of his, like, weird...
Oh, my God.
That's what, right? That's what they have to do for Ant-Man 3.
That's the first scene of Ant-Man 3,
yes.
is him doing that for Scott, because Scott never, you know, Scott's so busy in this movie, he never really had time to fully catch up. He only knows some of the
yeah.
vague shit of, like, Thanos happened, I guess. Like, yeah, like, that would make sense. Like, yeah, explaining it to him and Hope. Yeah. So, yeah, like, and also I think the other one, Doctor Strange, has, like, some space to deal with this more because of, like, all the weird
mm-hmm.
metaphysical shit. Like, I feel like Doctor Strange can maybe, there's space in that movie to address some of this stuff more directly than, like, you know, it's so far outside of Spider-Man's fucking pay grade. Like, Spider-Man
yes.
doesn't, like, Spider-Man's fighting fucking Mysterio in the next movie. Mysterio is literally, like, a stunt guy turned evil. Spider-Man is not capable of dealing with the effects of the time, the 5 year time gap, and half the population having been vaporized and coming back to life. That's outside of his scope. So, yeah, I'm curious to see how those movies deal with it. But then, just like, what does the Marvel Cinematic Universe look like from here? Like, does Falcon become Captain America? Does he get his own Captain America movie? Like, is there a new team of Avengers they make that, like, do they keep on having Avengers movies with a different makeup? Like, there's so much potential for them to be able to mix up, like, the scheme of what they've been doing. And it's very interesting to me that they have not talked about it yet, but it makes sense because, you know, you don't want to spoil anything from this movie with your news of movies in the future. I'm very curious to see when they're going to reveal what their plans are, because you know that they're already set in motion. You know they have a bunch
yeah.
of shit there. Getting ready for the next set of movies.
You know, Disney Plus is the big X factor here, I think, because they have three series planned. They have Loki, which we talked about earlier. They have the WandaVision show, which Vision is dead. Vision does not come back. So, like, I assume that's that's the one I have a question about. I'm not sure what that show is going to
yeah.
be.
I think at least you could, since Vision is a robot and his carcass was left at the end of
oh,
Infinity
yeah, they could
War,
do that, yeah.
They could bring, you could find a way very naturally to bring Vision back, which is what I'm guessing they will do.
Have Mark Ruffalo cameo in the first episode as Hulk Banner, and he is
yes.
he's helping Wanda put Vision back together. That writes itself. All right.
Yeah.
And then you've got, they're also planning a Winter Soldier Falcon TV show. Which I feel like, and they don't have a title for that yet. They should call that, like, New Captain America or something. And
yeah, Captain America and the Winter Soldier or something.
Yeah, and, like, that could be, because I actually like the idea of that being a TV show. Like, now, because what their plan now is that, like, they're winding down all the other Marvel TV shows. Like, the last one standing, I think, is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and it's about to end. And, well, no, there is that third season of Jessica Jones that... Did that come out yet, or is it... I don't know. Whatever the case.
No, they definitely is not out yet now.
Okay.
Yeah, I do not know what's happening with
that.
But
we know the show's not coming back for a season after that. So, like... And if you don't know, the whole drama is that the Marvel TV team was different than Kevin Feige's movie team, and they never liked each other. So, like, on Disney Plus, where they're going to be doing Marvel shows now, Kevin Feige has a lot more command over that, and it's a different team, and these TV shows are going to tie into the movies more. And I think that's smart, because I think there's a chance to do some cool stuff where, like, a new Captain America, Falcon, Winter Soldier show, that almost sounds more interesting to me as, like, a 6-episode show than it would a movie, you know?
I agree, yeah, because I think they've just already done so many Captain America movies that even if you switch the character, I think like the first Sam Wilson Captain America movie would have like a lot of baggage to deal with.
Yeah.
That if you have an episodic thing, it would be much easier to deal with all that baggage and then also be able to like have some fun smaller scale plots.
So hopefully they can figure all that out. You know, there's still that they were going to make that Squirrel Girl show and they cast it and they shot a pilot and it was for ABC Family. And then ABC Family shut down, and now it's been like a year and a half, and they say the show is still out there, but they haven't announced where they're going to air it. I just want my Squirrel Girl show, you bastards.
Yeah, it's too bad that they already defeated Thanos, so they can't have the classic sequence where Squirrel Girl defeats Thanos off-panel and just reminisces about it to... I forget who she's telling. I think it's to Uatu the Watcher or someone. There's a very famous comic panel where she just talks about, oh yeah, I kicked Thanos' ass.
It was Milana Weintraub from... She's done a lot of cool YouTube stuff. She was going to be Squirrel Girl. I was really excited for that. I hope it actually comes out. Anyway, yeah, so...
But yeah, that's one of the things I would like to see them be able to do now is move into some smaller scale stuff because that's the side of the Marvel Universe they haven't delved particularly deep into is some of the smaller scale, more obscure characters because they've been dealing with mostly like the primary members of the Avengers who deal with the biggest scale threats. So some of that kind of stuff, bringing some of that kind of stuff into a movie format could be fun. The other question is with all their Fox acquisitions, how does that play in? Are we going to now see, are they going to make a Fantastic Four movie?
They've got to. Like, I don't know how much of a priority it is for Disney, but I feel like Kevin Feige must be salivating at that, right? Like,
yeah.
The chance to finally do Fantastic Four right must be such an attraction to him. X-Men is the question mark for me. Like, I don't even know how you integrate the X-Men into this world because... Because mutants would have had to be there before. There are already... Would people be surprised at mutants? It's like there's a million fucking superheroes and we all died a year ago. Like, what would that even mean?
Yeah, it would definitely stretch the boundaries of the suspension of disbelief to have a bunch of people just be mutant racist all of a sudden in the Marvel Universe after all this shit. Like, you could have, after the first couple of movies, after Avengers Endgame, where we've lived 5 years on Earth where half the population was, like, disintegrated by an evil alien titan, like... Yeah, I don't think they're just going to turn around and be like, oh, that dude, like, has mind stuff he can do. Oh, we should, like, treat him like he's, you know, like they make this a whole weird metaphor for, like, homophobia or something.
Because my understanding is in the comics, X-Men is already fairly gardened off from the rest of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, the X-Men very rarely interact with other elements of the Marvel Universe because there's so many X-Men characters, like, there's just not a lot of space to do. It's only Wolverine. Wolverine is, like, the one that gets to go around and play with other... Like, him, Scarlet Witch, and Quicksilver are the ones that get to play around because Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are Avengers, so...
Yeah. So, yeah, who knows? We'll see. I think Fantastic Four is the one I'd be excited for them doing more stuff with because... we know it can work. We just haven't seen it work yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we'll see. You know, we'll be back here in a couple months to talk about Spider-Man. And then after that, there's going to be a bit of a break. And yeah, Brave New World. Kind of.
I hate you just said that because I'm literally teaching Brave New World to juniors right now.
Oh.
And you saying that just like, you literally the phrase Brave New World just made me feel extremely stressed out.
I'm sorry.
Ugh. Brave New World with such movies in it.
All right. So next week, Sean, we'll talk about something. I'm not sure what. I'm going to be out in Colorado in a week or two. And we'll probably do some stuff together while I'm out. So we'll plan that. And yeah, I mean, this is a busy month for movies. We've got Detective Pikachu May 10th, John Wick 3 the week after that, Aladdin the week after that. May 31st is something, and I'm forgetting what it is, but it's something I'm excited for. And then Dark Phoenix is June 7th. Like, it's just every week for a while there's at least interesting movies. And I've also got to say, that Detective Pikachu trailer really plays to an audience. Did you notice that, too?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, like... Because I've only seen that trailer on, like, YouTube. And so... And, like, I think I've... Maybe I'd only seen that trailer on YouTube on my phone.
Yeah.
I don't remember if I've watched it on my laptop or not. So it plays really well in a movie theater. Like, for an audience, it plays well, but just, like, the theatrical experience of seeing fucking Charizard on, like, a realistic-looking Charizard on a movie theater is like, okay, I kind of get this a little bit more. Like, I always thought it was kind of a cool-looking movie. It makes even more sense seeing it in that context. It makes it feel more real to me and less like a, like, really nice-looking fan trailer, which is always what it kind of looked like. It was, like, a super high-budget fan trailer. Now it's like a, no, this is a real movie. Okay.
I'm looking forward to it, and based on the audience reactions, I think that movie's going to be a monster hit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Movie I'm not looking forward to, because I also saw the trailer in front of Endgame, is that fucking Dark Phoenix movie.
I know.
Looks so fucking bad.
Oh, well. We'll be back next week. We'll talk about something. Maybe, Sean, do you want to do a rewatch of Pokemon, the first movie?
Is that a serious offer or are you joking? I can't tell. I legitimately can't tell. Because I can go get a fucking VHS, because I have that movie on VHS, so I can break out a fucking VCR.
Avengers,